The James Whale Show on Talk Radio.
Oh, yeah, there you are. Right, I've got a bone to pick with you.
Oh, here we go.
You know, I listened to you on the way home last night, tried to phone in and get on under the name of Nigel.
Why are you with me all the time? You used to love me and now you seem to always have a go at me. What's going on? What's happened to us?
He's very upset.
Yeah. Why is he upset with me?
Well, because you're a Ramona for a start and all you got... Look, we are leaving the European Union,
Has he had his tablet today? I mean, we're always a bit worried when he hasn't. He's starting on the...
Do you know Annabelle?
I don't know you, Annabelle, but hello.
We have met once. Oh, okay. Once before. But clearly, I'm quite
forgettable. No, you came on and I remember you came on and did something, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. There we go. She's a chief Brexiteer.
Oh,
she's
well, never mind. My condolences.
Anyway.
So have you accepted the result happening on the, we're leaving on the 31st of January?
Oh, I think that Boris will betray all of you and he'll end up doing the softest, fluffiest Brexit going in order to then massage his ego. It'll all be a huge success. Everyone will have to claim it's Brexit because otherwise their egos will be damaged and we'll all move on. So I'm actually quite happy.
Well, that's fine then.
I'm quite sure he'll stab all of Marc Francois. Doesn't need Marc Francois. Doesn't need Jacob Rees-Mogg. Doesn't need all those crazies anymore.
I mean, you can push the ERG to one side.
Exactly. Doing lovely, soft, fluffy alignment to EU and all of that kind of stuff. Because he's a Remainer. He is a Remainer.
Just a minute. Yes. Right. We are going to leave the European Union.
Yes.
And we are already aligned with them as far as our trade policies are concerned. Yeah. It'll be easy just to do it. It'll be done.
Absolutely.
Right? And the reason why some ministers come from the House of Lords, which was really getting up your nose, which you seemed not to be able to grasp, is because in this interim period before they have the main reshuffle, what's her name, Morgan?
Nikki.
Doing a very good job before, decided she didn't want to be political anymore.
Fair play to her, because she was being trolled and abused.
I actually think, I don't know whether it's people like him or not, but I wouldn't mind betting he does a bit of trolling himself under a different...
I'd stab you in the front of your face. I wouldn't do it behind your back.
See what I mean? But... Yeah, it was really upsetting, but she was doing a good job.
She was.
She's been sent to the Lords, and he's asked her back to run she's been running that, so much better way to keep her in there.
Imagine someone unelected in a position of power. My word, that reminds me of somewhere in the European Union. Brussels! That's right, do you remember Brussels?
You're talking
unelected bureaucrats, where they're all presiding over us.
He's a flipping left-wing lovey, and I've no idea how he gets in this building.
Well, actually, to be honest. Firstly, that's the most insulting thing you've said to me.
You're not a left-wing lovey.
Thatcher is my goddess.
Don't you take my...
No, she's my goddess. She is my goddess. I absolutely love that woman. And actually, in the first hour...
You love her as much as I love her.
Well,
start taking that away from me.
This could come to blows.
In the first hour, we're going to talk about whether there's any appetite for socialism, because I think not.
No, of course not. It's finished.
Well, we know there's not now, don't we?
But they were still thinking there is.
I went out with Margaret.
You did.
We had a night out.
Did you?
We had a night out at Stringfellow's.
Did she have a whiskey?
I'll tell you sometime in the future. Got to go. See you after Christmas. Have a lovely time. Thank you, Annabelle.
Thank you.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Christo Fufas on Talk Radio.
Good evening, all. Christo here on Talk Radio. It's your late show with you until 1 o'clock. How are you? Thank you very much indeed for your company. Thank you, dare I say, to James Whale. Sorry, that was just like the bile just sticking in my throat. We only pretend to hate each other. Well, I pretend to hate him. He doesn't pretend to hate me. He's back, of course, in his rightful place. I think after Christmas now, but I'm here with you until 1 o'clock. Later, you just heard in our news headlines about the premiere of the new Star Wars film. Why is it popular? Why do you love it? Why are you obsessed with the Star Wars franchise? We'll talk about that a little bit later on, because I genuinely want to know what it is about that franchise, those films, that sort of make people a bit crazy, don't they? I mean, when they don't like one... Do you remember the last one that people didn't like? And it wasn't like, okay, we're going to do some bad reviews of it. There was a huge petition to have them to remake it. People were going online saying, we don't want this to be one of the installments. They were furious. People feel like, it's almost like speech radio, actually. It's almost like the abuse I get. It's like people feel like they have a just immense amount of ownership over these movies. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. What it is about Star Wars, the entire franchise, that gets you, just gets you in the gut, why you love it so much, but also why you hate it. And whether you're one of those people that just looks at it and says, oh my God, it's rubbish. And we might talk about other film franchises that have done well. And it's a conversation I really love having as well, is when sequels have worked brilliantly and when they've worked absolutely dreadfully as well. So we'll talk about that. In the next hour as well, something a little bit more serious. We'll talk about, there's a viral video that's been around. And we're going to play you a clip of that a little bit later on. But it's a gentleman, I think he's in his 50s. And he's really lonely. And he's just basically put it out there. So we're going to hear that video of him talking about how lonely he is. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about whether this time of year is one that really exposes if you're feeling lonely. We'll do that later, though. We're going to do that after 11 o'clock. But the phone lines are up and running, 0344 499 1000. I want to start off the show, as always. We'll start off a little bit more serious. And I want to talk to you about the comments of Tony Blair today and the fact that he has been essentially tearing Labour to shreds. Now, he'd know a thing or two about winning elections under Labour because, of course, he won three with the kind of landslide that I don't think you'll ever see again in British politics. And, well, should we hear some of what he's had to say? Because there are a few things he said today. He's been pretty scathing of Jeremy Corbyn. He's spoken about Labour renewing itself. It's all of these sorts of things that he's been discussing about why they lost the election, what they need to do going forward. All of these suggestions from a man who, I think what's interesting as well when you listen to this is just remember, this is a man who is widely loathed throughout the wider Labour Party membership. I think it's fair to say, because Blairism and being a Blairite is seen as a really, really bad thing if you're in the current Labour Party. Now, personally, I would say that they should probably be listening to him rather than going back to a time in the 80s where they were socialists. And that's what the manifesto that they had this time was as akin to socialism. So let's hear Tony Blair talking about Labour and Jeremy Corbyn and the like. This is him suggesting that, well, the way they have to renew themselves.
The choice for Labour is to renew itself as the serious, progressive, non-conservative competitor for power in British politics, or retreat from such an ambition, in which case it will be replaced. That is how stark, harsh, difficult, but true the choice is. And the choice is now.
He also spoke about Corbyn and the policies that Corbyn put forward and, well, whether he was the right choice of leadership.
The absence of leadership on what was obviously the biggest question facing the country then reinforced all the other doubts about Jeremy Corbyn. He personified politically an idea, a brand of quasi-revolutionary socialism, mixing far-left economic policy with deep hostility to Western foreign policy, which never has appealed to traditional Labour voters, never will appeal to them, and represented for them a combination of misguided ideology and terminal ineptitude that they found insulting.
So, I mean, that's really scathing, isn't it? I mean, let's remember, he is actually a part of the Labour Party. You wouldn't think it, would you? You think he's in opposition?
Goodness.
We've also got him, don't know what that was, but we've also got him discussing their choice to actually give the election, to give permission for this election to take place, and whether that was a good decision.
No sentient political party goes into an election with a leader who has a net approval rating of minus 40%. The takeover of the Labour Party by the far left turned it into a glorified protest movement with cult trimmings, utterly incapable of being a credible government. The result has brought shame on us we let our country down. To go into an election at any time with such a divergence between party and people is unacceptable. To do it at a time of national crisis, when a credible opposition is so essential to the national interest, is unforgivable.
So, really scathing words from Tony Blair there, but of course, he recognises, I think as many other people do, that the platform that Labour stood on in the election, which saw them absolutely trounced, which saw the working man, what Thatcher used to call the demographically, the C2 voter, sort of aspirational working class, Mondeo man, I think it was how he was described during Blair's years, completely abandoned the party and go for the Tories. And that's because, well, partly of Brexit, I think, though what's interesting is Labour were never saying that at the time, that it was the Brexit election, but also, I think, because of people's real fears of socialism and whether we could return to a socialist ideology in this country. And that was what Blair was just referencing in the comments he made. So I'd like to know from you on 0344 499 1000. Simply, is there any appetite for socialism in this country? Are you someone that didn't consider Brexit in this election and voted for what you saw as socialism? And do you think there'll ever be an appetite for it back in this country? Do you think that Labour are right? Is there anyone out there who agrees with Labour that actually this was nothing to do with Jeremy Corbyn's policies? Let me read you a really interesting quote. And I still can't believe this quote. And I've read it so many times on so many different programmes on talk radio, but it still doesn't fail to absolutely amaze me. And this is Laura Parker. She's the national coordinator of Momentum, which, as you know, is the group within Labour, big group within the membership of Labour. And she has said, after this election, we will keep the Labour Party socialist. There is no appetite to go back to the centrist policies of old. So there are many people within the Labour Party. Did you hear Richard Burgeon on Politics Live today? Oh, my word. I mean, the fact that Richard Burgeon's even thinking of standing as deputy leader. I mean, if Richard Burgeon is the answer, I have no idea what the question is, frankly, because he is not a competent man. He doesn't come across as competent at all. And even he was saying, once again, this was all about Brexit. It was all about Brexit, and they underestimated in Labour how passionate people felt about Brexit. But they were saying all along through the election that it was nothing to do with Brexit and it wasn't a Brexit election. And this was about the other issues. So they don't seem to be able, not everyone within there, but they don't seem to be able to get their head around the fact that there is no appetite for socialism in this country. If there was, Labour would have got a landslide, surely. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you disagree. I really respect if you do. I really understand that maybe you want to give me a call and tell me why you disagree. Or are you someone that just would do anything to avoid a socialist government here in the United Kingdom? 0344 499 1000. Let's talk to Chris, who's in Colchester. Hi, Chris.
Hiya.
So, go on.
Well, you say about that, but in 2017, and I'm no Corbyn fan, no Labour fan, but he was a few thousand votes away from becoming Prime Minister if he'd got him in the right constituencies. The things that have changed since then is that the Blairites in the party have got Corbyn and others to change their mind about, or not change their mind, change the policy on Brexit and push this second referendum, which was completely insane, to then have a second referendum and then campaign against it, a lot of the Blairites would have. And then also, he's been smeared to hell with these crazy theories about him being an anti-Semite.
They're not crazy. They're not crazy.
Well,
Chris,
they are crazy.
They're not crazy.
Yeah, he's not. They are crazy. He's not an anti-Semite. There's 150 out of 500,000 members I mean, that's 0.08% of the party.
Why do the equalities... okay, I don't know whether Jeremy Corbyn personally is an anti-Semite. I know he's done a lot over the years to fight different forms of racism, but I also know that he's laid wreaths at memorials of people that were in extremely carried out horrific actions, especially towards those athletes in Munich. You've also got the situation where he has written forewords in books that have anti-Semitic things written inside them. There are so many examples of a membership of the Labour Party that he presided over and didn't take action against, where there were examples of anti-Semitism. And the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, which ironically Labour founded, are investigating them based on credible evidence of it being institutional within the party. Now, maybe himself personally, he's just made some absolutely dreadful decisions, but you cannot just say blanket that it's just some sort of conspiracy or something along those lines, because the Equalities and Human Rights Commission wouldn't bother investigating a conspiracy. And at the very least, he only started taking action when the pressure was really on. When I've seen it myself, Labour activists online putting out the most horrific abuse towards members of the Jewish community. And I've got friends who are members of the Jewish community who are lifelong Labour voters who were genuinely scared. Now, they weren't Tory plants. They weren't people who were engaging in conspiracy theories. They were Jewish people who were systematically abused and trolled by the Labour membership, a membership that Jeremy Corbyn presided over. So sorry, Chris, I'm not having that. He might not be himself, but at the very least, he was complicit by not taking action quickly enough.
Well, like I said, it's 150 members. It's really ridiculous.
But it's enough to make Jewish people scared.
Well, it's propaganda. We need to get away from this guilt by association. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn was fighting against anti-Semitism from the far right in the 1970s, from the National Front. The reason he was against apartheid as well in South Africa, he's against apartheid in Israel, and that's the trouble. And it's the Israeli lobby that are terrified, and they're in the party. Watch the undercover Al Jazeera documentary about the Israel lobby, where a guy from the Israeli embassy said he could take down Sir Alan Duncan because he was critical of Israel. And there's a fight between pro-Israel Jewish people and anti-Israel Jewish people in the party. And for Blair, who took us to Iraq, that's killed over a million people, to come and start virtue signalling, I mean, what's worse? People being offended, or a million people dead because of a pack of lies that we went to war in. And this guy needs to get the hell out of politics, Tony Blair. He should be in The Hague. He would have fouled at Nuremberg, taken us to war on a pack of lies that killed him. It's disgusting. Well, why won't this guy go away?
Because he won three elections by moving Labour away. If you're so passionate about Jeremy Corbyn being someone who should be in office, well, don't you care about winning an election? Don't you care about hearing from the only Labour leader who's won an election in 45 years? I mean, you've got to listen to him. You've got to listen at some point to, or have at least some respect for him for having done that. I'm not a big fan of Tony Blair myself. I happen to agree with you. I think that dossier that him and Alistair Campbell wrote was more fictitious than a Jackie Collins. But I respect the fact that the man won three elections on the trot with huge majorities, and that's because he tried to bridge the gap between compassionate conservatism, if you like, a pro-business government that understands that business money has to be spent on public services and improving standards for people. And I think that's the only way that Labour's ever going to get elected, rather than the ridiculous stuff coming out of Corbyn's mouth and McDonald's mouth in the run-up to the election, berating people for wanting to be billionaires, berating people who were earning too much money.
I don't agree with their economic policies. I think they're insane, what Corbyn and McDonald were offering. You know, saying, oh, free this, free Wi-Fi, free everything. It was complete madness. And that was another reason Labour did so badly.
So can't you put what Blair... I understand, and you are not alone in what you're saying about Blair and Iraq, but can't you, with what sounds like a pretty, you know, well screwed on head when it comes to economics, can't you put aside your dislike for him and say, right, actually, economically, if we're going to win as the Labour Party going forward, we should listen to at least what this man has to say about the direction and ideology of the party. Not necessarily policy, not necessarily Iraq, but the direction and the ideology of the party, because socialism is dead.
I don't think they have to be that crazy socialist. I mean, but no, I don't. It's a difficult one because I'm not a socialist. But if they want to be half sensible with it, with some of these, these nationalisation policies are quite popular with people. But just offering free stuff for everyone, that's, it's, you know, it gets down the roads of communism. It's crazy.
But when it comes to nationalisation, Chris, and these well, firstly, I'm not sure that anyone who lived through the 70s, the older voters, will be as enthused about socialism and nationalisation, rather, than younger voters. Because I think for younger voters, it sounds a better idea than it actually was in practice in the 70s. So you've got that aspect of it. But secondly, you talk about economics, you talk about free stuff. When you're going to renationalise things that are in the private sector, that is going to cost a fortune. How the hell are you going to pay for that? People didn't believe that they could pay for all of that.
No, I agree. I don't agree with the but they're quite popular. I don't think that's the reason why they lost. I thought there was a lot of factors, and I think Blair done a lot of damage to the party. I mean, I thought John Smith would have won the election as well if he would have been leader in 97, because I think people were sick of Thatcherism, and Blair just sort of took that mantra on, and he done a lot of deals with people like Murdoch to get favour. He was being warned about, and then he did a deal with Murdoch to get favour. The press were very kind to Tony Blair.
Yes, because he was pro-business, and no one in the press, whether you love or loathe the press, no multi-million, billion-pound media mogul is going to say, great, for the whole of the country, we should be anti-business. And Blair was very good at understanding that you need to actually court business, not just big business, but small business. My parents have been small business owners all their lives. They were petrified of socialism because they needed to know that whomever was going to be in government was going to be pro-business. And I'm sorry, Corbyn, love or loathe him, didn't come across as someone who was pro-business. And you can... That's pretty obvious by the fact that he wanted to tax people who earned a lot of money. He wanted to put up corporation tax. It was all the things back to the 70s. And I'm not sure that anyone who lived through that period would want to return back to it. But Chris, it doesn't sound like we disagree massively. You just felt that Corbyn was quite unfairly treated. But I'd really like to know whether anyone agrees with Chris and whether there is an appetite for socialism. 0344 499 1000 is the number to call. Coming up, we're going to be talking to the former Labour MP for Ealing North, Stephen Pound, to find out what is next for Labour and whether he believes there's any appetite for socialism going forward. So all of that and more. It's Christo here on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Christo Fufas on Talk Radio.
Good evening, Christo here on Talk Radio. Thank you very much indeed for your company tonight. In about half an hour's time, we'll bring in something new for you and I to discuss. We'll be talking about the viral video of the man who simply admitted that he was feeling really, really lonely this time of year. And so we'll talk about the concept of loneliness and whether you are someone that feels lonely. Is loneliness a bit of a state of mind? Because I found a really great article about it as well, which I want to share with you a bit later on, about someone who is going to be spending Christmas on their own, and they've got such a good attitude about it. I wonder if it will help some of us that worry about this kind of thing. And as well, I should say, by the way, in the next hour, we'll be talking to Dame Esther Ranson about that very subject. We might also talk as well, and I don't want it to be too depressing, about grief this time of year, and whether this is the time of year that really brings it back to you if you're feeling like you miss someone. And a really uplifting story I want to bring you. In fact, we might find the audio. Do you remember the second, I'm just going to tell my producer this, remember the second story I sent you on this hour? Can we find a bit of the audio of the thing that's referred to in that story? Because it's really heartwarming, and I think you'll love it. I hope so. But that's in the next hour. We're still talking about the comments of Tony Blair today, essentially really berating where the Labour Party are at the moment. The choice for Labour is to renew itself as a serious, progressive, non-conservative competitor. Otherwise, he was saying it would be replaced, that there was an absence of leadership in this election. Corbyn had mixed different policies which haven't appealed to traditional voters. Essentially as well, saying that standing on a platform of socialism doesn't win elections anymore. And when you look at the results of the last election, you would probably be inclined to agree. 0344 499 1000. Are you someone who has any appeal whatsoever for socialism? Do you think the UK will ever be socialist, in inverted commas, again? Let's now cross live to the former Labour MP for Ealing North, Stephen Pound, who joins me live on the line. Evening to you, Stephen.
Good evening, Krista.
Thanks for taking
the
time. I have
to say, you're in a cheerful mood tonight, matey, aren't you?
I actually am. Weirdly.
It's most unlike you, if I may say.
Thank you very much indeed. I mean, you must listen regularly to my Ramoning, I presume.
I listen to you on this and at least one other station.
Well, I'm very cheerful. I'm always cheerful now, Stephen. Not necessarily because of the election result, but I'm kind of getting over the Ramoning and all of that, because I don't think there is much of a choice about what's going to happen going forward. But also, I have to be honest, as much as I absolutely loathe Boris, I think that he shows a level of honesty that is just, well, it's non-existent, really. I think that I've never known a party win an election based on telling such outright lies, but I was still relieved it wasn't Jeremy Corbyn in Downing Street, and I don't think I'm alone in that. Do you recognise that maybe that's where people were in this election?
Well, I'd be a complete fool if I tried to deny it. I mean, not all people were, but a considerable amount of people were. In fact, in your sort of sting, your intro at the beginning, when you were talking about somebody ringing you and saying how desperately lonely they were going to be at Christmas, and they were going to be abandoned by all their friends and, you know, on their own with no one to talk to, I thought, hello, Jeremy's been ringing in, has he not? Because it's quite depressing how his people, you know, up until, you know, a couple of weeks ago, you had the people sort of clinging around him and acolytes fawning about him. It's like that Wyatt poem, "They flee from me that once did seek my hand." And it's quite depressing to see him in that situation. But your quote about Tony Blair was extremely interesting when he talked about reconnecting with core votes and things like that. I think what people have got to realise is that the demographics of the United Kingdom have changed. There isn't an industrial working class anymore. We don't have thousands and millions of shipyard builders. We don't have coal miners. We don't have people working in the steelworks. We don't have that unionised, organised blue-collar workforce anymore. It just simply doesn't exist. The most worrying thing for me about last Thursday, apart from the fact that, you know, my lot got mullered, was the fact that the Labour Party is now an urban party. The Tory Party was always the party of the shires and, you know, the green, leafy, open fields, and we were very often the party of the mean streets of the cities. But the towns was where the elections were fought and won and lost. We seem to have lost the towns. We seem to have lost what country ones we did have, you know, places like, you know, Dennis Skinner's old seat in Bolsover, which is rural but was Labour. And if we're going to be reduced to a urban party in Bristol, Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, London, Newcastle, there's not much future for us. There's really not much future for us. And I think that when Tony Blair talks about reconnecting and things like that, he can't turn the clock back to 1997. I wish to God we could. I mean, my hair would grow back for a start, but I mean, it'd be marvellous if we could, but we can't. And I think what we have to do is to look at a new polity, an entirely new demographic. People have now got pick-and-mix attitudes towards politics. Tribal loyalties no longer apply. I hardly know anybody who, when you knock on the door, say, can we count on your votes? And, oh, yes, I'll be voting for you because my dad did or my mum did. They don't say that anymore. They now actually weigh it up, and it's pick and mix. They'll say, I'll have a bit of this, I'll have a bit of that, and what's the best one for me? So we've got to appeal to a new mobile, short, sort of focused group of people who have they take their media in a different way, they eat different food, they travel in a different way, they work in a different way, but above all, they think differently about politics. It's no longer becoming the tribal politics of my day. And I think that for the first time in my life, you know, I first got elected in 1982 onto the council, I've done 37 years, I can actually see the kind of emerging, as the kaleidoscope turns, the shape of something different in politics. Like Nisa Nandy said yesterday in the House of Commons, The ground is crumbling underneath our feet. I don't believe that the Tories can stay with this cohesion for much longer, because they are led by a mendacious charlatan. And, you know, this is a Boris Johnson. He's been fired from about three jobs for telling porkies. He's a complete scoundrel. I'm not sure they can hold it together, and I'm not entirely sure that he's going to be able to sell the idea of out by January the 31st and then 5 years of negotiations to a lot of his hardcore Brexiteers. So the only people who are going to be really happy are people like you, because you've got a target-rich environment for the next few years. I think for our country, I weep, for our industry and for our politics and for our democracy, and the essential core decency of the British people, I worry at the moment, because we're under terrible, terrible strain.
Well, I saw this thing online and you must have seen it as well, the phrase that you should look at the people that are maybe the poorest or most vulnerable in society and vote for their best interests at the election. And I've never really done that before. I've always voted quite selfishly. But this election, I thought, you know what? No, I'm going to vote for what I see as the best interests of the country rather than perhaps my personal best interests. But the problem is, all those vulnerable people were busy voting for the Conservatives.
I think they were, but the core point here is that, I mean, in the past, there was, some people would say, well, you know, you've got the deserving poor and the undeserving poor, or the poor always with us. I mean, I think somebody once said, you know, this country will not be a good place for any of us to live in unless it's a good place for all of us to live in. And it's when we've got this massively disenfranchised, disconnected, completely out of touch and out of contact group of people, a growing number of people, then I don't think we can actually have a peaceful polity in this country, because the logical extension of where we are at the moment with this great divide is walled communities. Those gated communities are going to be springing up all over the country, and there's going to be the barbarians at the gates. We're going to have the people outside the walls and the people inside the walls. And that is a recipe for absolute disaster. And I don't think we can actually go into this century on that basis of having some people who we're simply going to ignore, because they will be the ones battering down on the gates of these communities, climbing over the walls and setting, you know, everybody in paroxysms and tremors of horror.
But do you think it's fair to say that many of those people, Brexit was clearly a big factor in the election, though Labour themselves were the ones saying it wasn't up until when the results started to come in. They were saying it was about everything else other than Brexit. But do you think it was a vote against socialism rather than a vote for Boris?
I don't. I mean, I'm a bit of a sort of a misty-eyed romantic. I believe, like John the Baptist, in pure socialism. You know, I actually believe in common ownership. I think that the railways, and I think that our health service, I think the prison service, I think they all should be belonging to the public. I don't like the idea of paying for my electricity to a company in Germany and paying for my gas or my water to some company in France.
But you remember they were appallingly run, though, Stephen. You remember the fact that was all pretty dreadful when...
Christa, I didn't mention telecoms.
No, the rest of it wasn't great either, was it?
Well, no. In the days when you used to have to wait for 3 months to get a telephone, that was bloody awful. But, you know, we haven't sold off our telecoms outside the UK. We have sold off our gas, water and electricity and our railways. And I'm sorry, the railway system I don't think is much, much better nowadays. And as for the water supply, you know, we've still got worse water all over the place. We're not getting that sort of high standard that we could reasonably expect. But what's even worse is that we're creaming off great chunks of money off the top and sending it to shareholders all over the world. Now, that can't be right. However you look at it, if we are paying 20% of the income of a water company to shareholders in Europe, that is 20% that could be invested within the UK. Now, I call myself a social democrat.
Sorry, but that's presuming that they would make the same sorts of profits if they were publicly owned. And the problem is, when they were publicly owned last time, they were hugely loss-making, and that's why Thatcher was able to come in and say, you know what, look, these are all complete... he's not making any money.
Chris, they were never loss-making because they didn't have to make a profit. They didn't have to make a profit. What they were is quite frequently, they were judged on a yardstick of efficiency and capability and performance, and they quite frequently failed. I'm not going to argue that. But they weren't loss-making because they weren't supposed to make a profit. We didn't expect British Rail to make a profit. We expected British Rail to give good value for the amount of public money that went into it, and we expected them to provide a decent service. We didn't expect Thames Water to make a profit. That was they weren't.
But doesn't the desire for profit and something being run in a sort of a profit aspirational way, perhaps I understand what you're saying, that while they're in public hands, it's not about profit, but it's the desire for profit that drives efficiency and drives standards up. I mean, that was Thatcher's massive ethos, wasn't it? No. The competition and the desire for profit is going to give the consumer better choice and it's going to drive up standards.
I think she got that completely wrong. I'll give you one good example that absolutely proves the nonsense of that argument. I spent years working in the National Health Service. Mm. I never met a single nurse who ever said, I must be better today because I'm going to make profit for, you know, my commissioning care group, whatever it's called. I never met anybody in the health service who thought about anything.
The health service, you're right, it's never been run for profit, but one of the major criticisms of the health service, which you must acknowledge, is that they pay through the nose and they overpay for certain items. There's a terrible amount of waste because, you know, nothing's reused. It's all kind of thrown away. And at the end of the day, if it was not necessarily being run for profit, because I understand the health service really can't be, but if there was perhaps a mindset of efficiency that profit brings, then that would be better for everyone concerned. It would cost less money. And I think that the problem with big state-owned entities is that sort of gets lost a bit, and then they tend to lose their efficiency and cost more than they would do in private hands.
Well, you're talking about fiscal discipline, and there has to be fiscal and financial discipline within any organisation.
But there isn't in the NHS.
The NHS is the biggest employer in the world. Third. I think it's the Red Army and the Indian National Railways are up there with it. And the NHS, if you're saying that they haven't got enough bean counts for the NHS, there's not enough middle managers, there's not enough financial accountants, then I'm prepared to listen to that. But the point being, I think one of the reasons why we are financially in a mess in the NHS, I won't deny it, is because of the reorganisations. I mean, in the last 15 years, we've had countless reorganisations. I mean, my local health authority has been a health trust. It's been part of Imperial. It's been part of North West Thames. It's been over and over again. It's been rebranded, rebadged. We've got new staff coming in. It's been chaotic.
Didn't Labour try and bring in a computer system that completely fell to bits as well?
Well, I have to say, our IT procurement in the UK, with the possible exception of the Passport Agency and DVLA, is not the best and most glorious record. But why, Chris? Why can't we do that? Why can't we use the NHS as a massive purchaser, the biggest purchaser in anywhere in the world like this, to actually drive down the prices of pharmaceuticals? Why can't we do it more? And I think maybe we actually need more state overview rather than individual managers who have an atomized perspective. Because however you look at it, somebody who's running a health service in Surrey is going to have a different perspective to someone who's running one in Sunderland, and they're not going to collaborate and not going to cooperate because they're different competing bodies. Now, it's all very well saying Sunderland and Surrey should be competing against each other and the outcome should be a better service. I say they should be working together to actually improve and to use the power, the mighty clout of their purchase ledger to actually drive down costs and make a better service.
Because you've seen the stories, and okay, I know sometimes these stories have a little bit of creative license, of the fact that, you know, for instance, they will buy light bulbs that will cost sort of ridiculous sums of money because the people who are supplying to the NHS know that they can charge that. And perhaps it's, you can explain better than I, maybe it's because people are stressed, maybe it's because they just want to get the light bulbs as quickly as possible, but they end up paying through the nose for things that are far cheaper. And I think that takes us to a wider attitude of big nationalised industries and how people see that they are run.
Well, the health service was a particular example with PFI, the Private Finance Initiative. And what happened with PFI was you actually had somebody had a contract to change a light bulb. Bonkers. They should have had an overall contract to actually maintain the light within the entire building. You know, the so-called hotel service aspect of hospital care. And that was just bad, bad planning. And frankly, there should have been a service level agreement. Like, you know, when I worked in housing, we had SLAs with our contractors. If I managed the tower block in Camden, which I did, I'd have a service level agreement once we lost our own direct works people, you know, with the electricians, with the window cleaners, with the heating engineers, and with the gardeners. And that SLA covered the whole of the work. And I competitively tendered that every year. and, you know, and drove down the prices to a point where I thought it was reasonable. So I don't think that that's a failure of the system. I think it's a failure of the policies within the system and the people operating it very, very poorly. But look, if you look at the social democratic model, I mean, people, the word socialism terrifies people. I mean,
anyone lived through the 70s was probably fairly terrified by socialism.
I was working at the Middlesex Hospital as a porter throughout the 1970s. I was fairly, fairly interesting memories of that. But look at Finland, look at Sweden, look at some of these countries that operate on a social democratic basis. If necessary, look at Portugal, which has just re-elected a socialist prime minister. Look at Spain, that's re-elected a socialist prime minister. Look at some of the other European countries. And I don't think that we're unique in this country. I'd like to be like Finland. I'd like to have higher educational attainments, massive, massive health advantages, no homelessness, nobody sleeping on the street. And, you know, okay, admittedly in Finland they'd probably be brown bread by breakfast time if they were sleeping on the street, but they have a much, much better quality of life. They keep coming top of every single... Now, why is that? They pay half as much again tax as we do in this country, and they put twice as much more into health and public service.
I get all of that. I take on board everything that you said.
I have no axe to grind for Finland, by the way.
Two questions to finish on then. How do you convince people that socialism isn't just about penalising people that do well? And secondly, if your arguments in favour of socialism are so credible, why have you not managed to convince the electorate that they are credible?
If I knew the answer to that last question, I would be running for the leadership of the Labour Party. I tell you, although I have to say, as a bloke from London, it's slightly unfair. I don't think the next leader of the Labour Party is going to be a London MP, believe you me. I think when you talk about it, I just say to people, what is the National Health Service? What is the National Health Service? What is the National Blood Transfusion Service? What is this relationship where people give blood for no profit for themselves, but for the greater good? And I can think, in a simple level, it's a sort of the social contract. You're driving down the road, as an ambulance comes up behind you, you pull over to let the ambulance by. Why? Because one day it could be you in that ambulance, and you'd want the person in front to pull over. It's just about living together in a community with a social contract. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But as for, you know, why we can't explain to people, unless, I think, in 1945, I think we...
Or convince them that it's not penalising them. I think that's the real thing that worries me. Those ridiculous comments made about, and I get the principle, no one needs to be a billionaire, but it's the idea that if you didn't have those people wanting and having the desire to be billionaires, you wouldn't have people employing people. You wouldn't have people going out, starting their own businesses and taking risks.
No, it's aspirational, and it's you do not want to damp down aspiration, and you don't want to damp down entrepreneurialism. I think, again, if you look at Finland, you get some of the best mobile phones in the world are made in Finland. They're made by people who actually went out there, patented particular designs, and produced them within the state ambit. And they're not state companies. You know, people like Nokia, they're not owned by the state. They're owned by individuals. Mm. You know, you can do it. I think the trouble with this country is we do have this strange delusion that all of us could actually end up in a sort of massive great mansion. When they were talking about the mansion tax on £2 million houses, people in council houses that they'd bought for £40,000 a few years ago, and at the most were worth a couple of hundred thousand, were saying, oh no, but I could live in a £2 million house one day. No, you couldn't. But on the other hand, I can't say to them, you know, I'm not going to, you know, sort of destroy their dreams and hopes. I can say, you know, maybe you could. And I think you've absolutely put your finger on it, that one word, aspiration. We can't damp down aspiration, and until we can actually persuade people to have aspiration for the nation rather than aspirations for the individual, then I'm afraid we're stuck in this sort of hamster wheel of capitalism.
And that's why I think and that's why I think Blair, I mean, love or loathe him, he did manage somehow to sort of straddle the two, didn't he? Trying to sort of show some compassion towards the public services that are required, but also being sort of pro-business and not intimidating people who had businesses and all those sorts of things. And that's exactly what the Labour Party needs to do going forward, isn't it?
Well, his great line about, you know, tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime was much more than just a cliche or a soundbite. It actually meant a very, very great deal. It meant that you can do both. And I think that the privatisation that he faced at the time, which he didn't contribute to, when you think that the idea that we privatise our prisons when the state should not be paying somebody to lock up fellow citizens, you know, he saw it had actually gone too far, so he wanted to actually look at the causes of the problem. I think the difficulty is that in the sort of the fiscal position we're in, particularly in the great crash in 2008, was that we couldn't somehow persuade people that we were anything other than corks tossing around on a sea of out-of-control rampant capitalism. And the only way to deal with that would be to stand up to have an accommodation with it. And I think when John McDonnell, God bless him, when he talks about his hobbies in Who's Who as being fomenting the overthrow of capitalism, I mean that's a perfectly reasonable ambition. But sadly, I think that just as the Labour Party owes more to Methodism than it does to Marx, so most political philosophy in this country is more to do with Freud than it is to do with Fidel. And I think that, you know, the Freudian idea that we are all individuals and we're not going to willingly give up something for our own disbenefit for somebody else's benefit is something we've really, really got to come to terms with. I'm not sure we can come to terms with it, but let's ameliorate, you know, the wilder, more bloodthirsty, well, sharp-fanged aspects of capitalism and do what we know we should do. We should have a safety net for people. We should look after the weak. We should realise that there are some people, you know, sort of, you know, the widows, the orphans, the people who've been with us for a long time but actually need some support and need some help. And we shouldn't be talking about feckless, you know, scroungers and things. I think we should recognise that we're one society, one group of people, one nation. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And when Boris Johnson talks about one nation conservatism, well, do you know, I'll give him a fair following wind. If he's going to come up with that, then I'll eat some of my words. I don't believe he can, but at least he's making the right noises at the present time. And on that note of inclusiveness, I think I should probably bow out.
Stephen Pound, former Labour MP, always a pleasure for Ealing North. What do you make of his comments? I mean, is there an argument for renationalising things, but to do so in a way that doesn't put off business, doesn't put off aspiration? And is that the major problem here, that the ideology of socialism is one that you immediately think quashes any kind of aspiration, any kind of ambition? Because that's the thing I loathe. I loathe the idea that you can, you know, I felt like after the financial crash, especially in this country, if you were someone who would say, right, I want to be a millionaire and I want to earn as much money as possible, people would look down their nose at you and be sort of disgusted. Whereas in America, if you say that kind of thing, people applaud you. They think you're great for that. And so I wonder whether we can ever get back to sort of somewhere between the two. 0344 499 1000. Coming up, we're also going to be talking about this time of year, perhaps bringing up things like loneliness, things like grief, and trying to put a positive spin on it. How can you actually get over that stuff and enjoy this festive period? So all of that and more coming up here on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Christo Fufas on Talk Radio.
Good evening. Christo here on Talk Radio. Stay with us. In the next hour, we'll be talking to Dame Esther Ranson. We'll be trying to get our head around how you can get through the festive season if you're someone who's feeling a bit lonely, or maybe it's the kind of time of year where if you've lost someone recently, it really sort of brings it to the forefront, doesn't it? So we'll be discussing that, your coping strategies. A couple of stories as well, which should actually uplift you when it comes to grief and being on your own at Christmas, and hopefully will help you out a little bit if you're one of those people. And we'll be talking as well about whether you are genuinely lonely, and like I say, trying to come up with some strategies to help you out. I think you could be lonely, by the way, in a room full of people. I don't think lonely necessarily always means being on your own. Oh, and then later we're talking about those big movie franchises that you either love or loathe. And someone texted me earlier to say, look, you can talk about Star Wars, but you've got to include Star Trek in that as well. Which, yeah, deal. I'll do that, because that was a massive movie franchise. It was the TV show and then the movie franchise. I remember in the 80s, waiting for a new Star Trek movie to come out. It was amazing. There was The Wrath of Khan and then The Search for Spock. Do you remember The Search for Spock? Like, at the time, and thinking it was so, like, high-tech, and now when you look, I don't like looking at those films now. It's like Superman. The 80s Superman films were amazing, but when you look back at them now, the special effects were terrible. But at the time, when you watched it, you thought, my God, he's actually flying. So we'll talk about that as well a little bit later on. But we've been talking about, as always, starting the programme a little bit more serious. We've been talking about Tony Blair's comments about where the Labour Party is heading, and you and I have been discussing whether there's any appetite for socialism, whether there's any appetite for a Blairite leader of the Labour Party, whether the only way Labour would ever get re-elected is to straddle aspiration, ambition and pro-business with some compassion when it comes to public services, and whether that kind of strategy will ever get them elected again, whether that kind of strategy would ever happen again. Simon is in Orpington. Hi there, Simon.
Christo, good evening.
What prompted you to pick up the phone about socialism? You're a big fan of socialism, right?
No, not at all. Krista, I might be quite dull this evening and we're going to probably agree with each other.
Oh, no. I'm changing my view. Changing my opinion okay, already. Yeah. I know I'm in the wrong now.
That's it. But you know what, Krista? I mean, fascinating discussion that you had with Stephen Pound there. What I picked up on, I thought was interesting, is he was saying that, you know, he'd like people to go out and, you know, become millionaires for the good of society. And you asked him, well, how do you actually go about doing that? And his response is, well, Krista, if I knew the answer to that one, I'd be running the Labour Party and running the country. So it seems to me that what Stephen Pound was saying is that, look, I've got a great political theory here. If only I can work out how to actually re-engineer people, it will work.
Well, again, it does seem to tie in a bit to, well, it's the electorate that are at fault, not us. But I yeah. kind of understood where he was coming from in as much as the examples he came up with where we are quite caring. You know, we do go and give blood. We do pull over for an ambulance. If there's ever an appeal and someone's in trouble, we do put our hands in our pockets. But I think yeah. we are quite unique in this country in as much as we want our autonomy to do that. We don't want the state to tell us you have to pay more and give it to us and we'll decide where it goes in the right place. Because I think that we don't trust the state to do that properly. But if we see it ourselves with our mm-hmm. own eyes, then, you know, we'll give away our last pound. I think in general, the UK is a really lovely place and we would give away all the money we had if we thought it would help people. But if we saw it with our own eyes and it was our decision. And I think that that's where governments, certainly UK governments, seem to have a bit of trouble. And maybe that's because we've no faith in politics. Maybe it's because we have had a really dull and turgid stream of incompetence that have been before us as MPs. But I don't think we trust the state to do it on our behalf.
Well, I think that's a really important point. It's interesting he used the example of giving blood. You know, the marketplace can't produce blood, so it has to come from somebody else. I think what Stephen Pound wouldn't accept is that actually the market has a solution to a lot of our problems in terms of prevention. Now, one example that I would use is that we have some kind of welfare state at the moment. That if you lose your job, there's something there. If you get ill, there's something there, even if it's not a lot. But if you go back to before the welfare state, you know, the welfare state is only 70 years old. So at this point in time, 70 years old in the run of things is still it's still at experimental stage. So it's not, you know, strange to say, actually, is this thing working? And say, if you go back before the welfare state, you won't remember this, but maybe some listeners will remember that they used to have a thing called the man from the Prue. And that was a guy who worked for the Prudential, who would go around the housing estates, the council blocks and things like that. And he'd go around on his bicycle and he'd sell like insurance coupons if people got ill or can't work. So people forget that actually the marketplace has solutions. You know, people could go out tomorrow. They don't do this, but they could go out tomorrow and insure their income so that if they lose their income because if they're sick and can't work, the insurer will pay out. But the trouble is people have fallen into this idea that there is something from the welfare state. And then they find out that actually they're in the state when it happens.
But isn't it important that, you know, we pay our taxes and our national insurance to a government? Isn't it important that as part of that contract, there are certain things that are always there for us? I mean, I agree that people on the whole need to take a little bit more personal responsibility sometimes. I think that a lot of the time we see the NHS and the waste that goes on and the fact that sort of people turn up to A&E with a broken nail or they'll ring an ambulance because, you know, they're worried about the football score or all those ridiculous things that do happen. You know, that is absolutely outrageous and unforgivable. We do have a situation where I saw a story in the newspaper, and I know again this isn't typical, but it does happen, where there were a couple with seven children who they had after the benefits cap came in, and they put on a crowdfunding page because they haven't got enough money for their children at Christmas. Well, I'm sorry, don't have children if you can't afford to feed them. And I do think it's really important that we do encourage people to be responsible, to be fiscally responsible, that the NHS itself is fiscally responsible, as I was saying to Stephen Pound as well. But we do need to provide that safety net, that level. And I think the problem with austerity is that it got cut back too much. And things like the bedroom tax, where you penalise someone for having a spare room, you know, that was wrong. That was completely wrong. I know the principle of it was correct, but
I think when people have fallen into this system, it is a trap. So I'm not actually for taking away people's benefits who are existing claimants. You know, you reach benefits of people who are on the dick. Well, the point is they can't go back to work.
No, but what did you think about, because again, this story really rings true in my mind. I remember doing it on the radio at the time, was the woman who lived in a four-bedroom flat in Westminster with her three children, and the housing benefit she was getting was £100,000 a year. And she took Westminster to court when the benefit cap came in, because they said to her, right, we've got a house for you and it's in Milton Keynes or somewhere. And she said, no, I shouldn't have to move there. And I think she won. Now, for me, if the state is saying to you, look, we can't afford to pay you £100,000 for your house in Westminster anymore because a normal average person can't live there, but here's a house in Milton Keynes, well, then you blooming well take it.
Well, absolutely, Christo. And that's the thing, is that somebody like from the Labour will talk about the safety net. Well, what we're talking about there is a whole funded lifestyle, isn't it? So, you know, that's entirely different. One example I would say as well is that, like, if you take our healthcare system, we pay, I mean, the NHS, this was reported a couple of years ago now, but it's in the Times, that the NHS is paying something like, it was paying like £3 for a box of paracetamol that you and I could go and buy for 19p.
Yes.
Now, you would never get away with that in business. Whoever is doing that purchasing would be, you know, fired, or there'd be a whole investigation.
Absolutely.
You'd never get away with it. And that's why the answer to the problems of the NHS, it's a shame when we get to election period and it's just more money for the NHS, more money for the NHS. I want the NHS to be there, but I want it to be run efficiently.
No, I agree, and that goes back to where we started, I think, because then, if we felt like the NHS was paying 19p for its bucks of paracetamol, but was still underfunded, I'd say fine, you know, that's right, extra tax, that's what's required. But when you have your extra taxes going to a government that is presiding over an NHS that's paying three times what it should, or five times what it should for a box of paracetamol, you're not going to be as happy to pay your extra taxes. I think you're right, Simon. I think we did agree. Thank you for your call. In the next hour, we'll talk a little bit more about this, but we'll also bring in the subject of someone who's gone viral for simply admitting that they were lonely. And Dame Esther Ranson will be telling us what she thinks of that and some solutions as well. All of that with me, Christo, here on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Christo Fufas on Talk Radio.
Just approaching 4 minutes past 11 on this lovely Wednesday evening. How are you? It's Christo here on Talk Radio. It's your late show with you till 1 o'clock. Then, of course, Daryl Morris takes over. Lots that we've been discussing. We've been talking about socialism, more about the ideology of socialism, actually, in the context, obviously, of Tony Blair's comments today, saying essentially that Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party as well, that they needed to renew themselves, that Corbyn had mixed these ridiculous different policies. So we've been talking about, would you be prepared, I guess this is what we've moved on to, would you be prepared to pay more tax if you thought that that money was being used more efficiently? And what's the thing about socialism that scared you so that you rejected it so overwhelmingly during the last election? 0344 499 1000 is the number to call. And you can also send me a tweet, Christo_radio. You can send me a tweet at Talk Radio as well. So loads of ways in which you can contact me this evening and tell us really why it is that socialism scared you so much. Or indeed, is there still an appetite for it with you? A few texts and tweets and then we'll move on. I'm going to say a fact that will probably shock most people. Well, actually, I stole this fact, Terry, in the last hour, so I should really give you the credit. I'm sorry for that. Terry in Portsmouth, can I say a fact that will probably shock most people? In the last 45 years, the Labour Party has only had one Prime Minister, Tony Blair. Yes, 45 years. I advise the Labour Party to listen to him. Thank you for that. I will never be ashamed, says York's Lass, for UK Labour or Jeremy Corbyn's policies, which would have reversed everything the Tories have destroyed and that the Blair government has achieved. 50 years a supporter slash member, but I will not vote Labour again if they move away from social democratic policies. Yeah, but York's Lass, again, interested to know, do you think they can bridge the gap between the two? Social democracy and pro-business, pro-ambition, pro-aspiration. Because they've got to try both. They can't just say, right, we'll tax everything, and if you're a billionaire, you're a bad person, and we'll raise corporation tax, and it's all about the most vulnerable in society. It is, but unfortunately, you've also got to pander to the people who are going to pay for that. You can't penalise the people who are going to pay for that. Because as you'll have heard, and Thatcher, I think, was one of the people that said this, yeah, the problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. So, thank you, though, for that. Really appreciate that tweet. Another one here. Actually, this moves on to the other subject that we were going to be talking about this hour. I want to discuss with you, and actually this hour, it's really exciting, so you've got to stay with us, because we're going to be talking to Dame Esther Ranson. And the reason that we're going to be having a conversation with her is on the subject of loneliness. Now, a British man has gone viral after simply admitting on a video, 52 years of age, he's a marketing CEO, and he's basically saying he's lonely. And apparently the video of him doing this, I don't know what platform the video was actually on. It was shared on LinkedIn. So it was on LinkedIn, and, well, should we just hear from what he had to say? Because this video apparently went absolutely everywhere. It's resonated with so many people, and this is what he had to say about loneliness.
Well, I have no friends. It's a scary thing to admit that, especially here on LinkedIn, but it's true. I know a lot of people, but it's mostly through networking and work and everything to do with work. I'm really lucky because I've got some amazing work colleagues, and you know, naturally we share our lives with each other, so we share what's going on. But you know, I don't take them out for dinner, and I don't go on long country walks with them. I don't do stuff with them that friends do. It's not just me as well who's got no friends. There are a staggering number of people, and mostly men across the UK, who've got very few, if any, people, friends, that they can actually talk about any sort of serious stuff with. And it's a tough one, isn't it? Because, you know, you don't want to be the sad, lonely git that admits to having no friends, but I haven't.
I mean, that's really candid, isn't it? To admit you've just got no friends and that you're lonely. And as I said, he was talking about the fact that he was lonely, that it was tough to admit that he had no friends. He was saying as well that the problem is that he's sort of too old to hang out with the younger people at work that go out to the pub all the time, and that's where they socialise, but too young to sort of give up on life, if you like. Not that you should give up on life at any age, really, but you know what I said. He said he's putting it down to being middle-aged and perhaps the most outgoing in the team, talking about his work life, and I like to see myself as the joker of the bunch, but when the clock hits 5 p.m. on a Friday and the 20-somethings disappear to the pub, I, their boss, sink off, home, alone. Now, without wanting to be too depressing about the whole thing, you know, this is a middle-aged man, and it is that demographic that is probably most likely, or that and younger, that is most likely to be the most suicidal. I mean, the most likely way that a man, I think it's aged 50 or under, will die will be through suicide. And I think loneliness must play a part in that, or feeling like you don't have a place. And feeling like if you do have a place, you can't speak up about these sorts of issues. So I've got immense admiration for this guy for saying this. And I guess what I'm asking you this hour is the same thing. Are you someone who suffers from loneliness? Is this the time of year where you start to really feel lonely, because it comes into really sharp focus that everyone's going home to their family, or everyone's got stuff to do, or everyone's very, very busy buying presents and socialising and going to parties. And if you haven't got all of that, it really makes you feel bad. And perhaps the rest of the time of the year, you can get on with stuff. But this time of year, it really hits you. 0344 499 1000. But as always, without it just being miserable and us all weeping into each other's arms and talking about how terrible everything is, are there solutions that you can come up with? I've read an article today about someone who's spending Christmas Day on their own, and it was brilliant because it was a guy. Shall I read it to you now? Shall I read a bit of it now, and then we'll get back to you. I will also talk a bit about grief as well, and another story that's actually really uplifting. It's a guy who's a writer, and he works for the Huffington Post. Matt Bagwell, his name is. And because of the fact that a few years ago, a relationship that he was in broke up just a couple of days before Christmas, he ended up spending Christmas completely alone. And he had friends that invited him round, but he didn't want to be that person that sort of turns up and not everyone knows them and everyone knows they're there because they were spending Christmas alone. He said he didn't want to live with that level of humiliation. So he made the decision to spend Christmas alone, and he really, really feared the thought of spending Christmas on his own. And then eventually he really enjoyed it. And now he says, I've done Christmas solo 3 times in the past, default initially. But once he made the decision to go it alone, he was anxious, but then he realized that he thought all of the, about those messages we're bombarded with, that you've got to eat this, drink that, spend, spend, spend. He said it felt liberating to do it his own way. He said rebellious even, to do my thing my way. And so he said he had a massive word with himself, realizing that for many people, spending Christmas alone isn't a choice. So instead of focusing on the festive FOMO, do you know what FOMO is? Fear of missing out. He actually said that he owned the decision and went from FOMO to JOMO, which is the joy of missing out. And once he embraced it, he said he couldn't wait for the day to come. So he went for a run Christmas morning, something he doesn't normally do. He basically decided that he would, what were the other things he did on the day? He met loads of people in the park because there were lots of dog walkers there. He then basically ate lots of cheese, ate lots of chocolate, drank too much wine, watched TV, but was completely content. And because of that, he did it again the following year. So rather than dreading spending Christmas on his own, he actually started to make it his conscious choice to spend Christmas on his own. And I really, really admire that. I really admire the fact that he owned the decision and now he just does that because he wants to. He doesn't want to spend it with other people because it's his day and that's how he's spending it. And I wonder if more people felt like that, then it would be a better way of coping with something that is traditionally really hard to cope with, and that is feeling really lonely. So are you someone that really relates to that? Are you someone that is dreading Christmas Day because you feel quite lonely? Is this the time of year where you feel quite lonely? And also, can you be lonely and actually still be with people? Because I think that is 100% true. Sometimes you could be in a room full of people and feel really lonely and feel like you don't fit in and feel like it's not right and something's a bit wrong. And that's fine. You know what? Well, that's actually okay. I think sometimes we beat ourselves up about these things. Like, I've spoken about this before, and weirdly, I always feel really lonely if I go clothes shopping. I don't know why, but you know when you're traveling around the department stores and you're on your own, you've got to go from one to another, and I get really depressed. That's when I feel really alone, is then. And I just feel a bit sorry for myself. You know, so sometimes that, if I don't have my dogs, that my dogs changed my life when it came to loneliness and mental health and all those sorts of things. And the builders are back at the moment. So because I'm spending time out and at work, I'm not leaving the dogs in the house. I won't leave the dogs in the house with the builders because I'm worried that the builders will leave the front door open and I'll come home and they won't be there. So I don't have them at the moment. So I'm going home to my big old empty house. That's a bit lonely. But again, it's really important to have a little word with yourself and go, look, it will pass. It's fine. So how do you cope? 0344 499 1000. We're also, like I said, talking about the concept and the principle and the ideology of socialism, and John's given us a call on that one in Warrington. Hi there, John.
Hi, good evening, Crystal. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. So, any appeal for paying more taxes and the socialist society that we were speaking about with Stephen in the last hour, Stephen Pound, the Labour MP?
No, I'm definitely, I mean, I have been a Labour supporter up until this election. I'm more of a, I've always been more of a centre of the party. The far left will never get anywhere in this country as far as I'm concerned. But my point about where the mistrust has come and where I've sort of drifted away from the Labour Party, when you talk about the manifesto and the, you know, the nationalisation of the water companies and the power of the gas and electric companies, but then the party's stance has been pretty much pro-Remain, and if they want to remain in the EU, they then won't be able to nationalise the things they want to, because the EU competition rules won't allow them.
So well, hang on, but no, but there are other countries that are within the EU that have big nationalised industries as well.
But the contracts still have to be tendered, don't they? They still have to tender the contracts and put them available to others to bid for.
Right, but that doesn't make it impossible. It might make it a bit more expensive, but it doesn't actually make it completely impossible to do that. But I see what you're saying, that you see that as a contradiction.
Yeah, because I voted to leave, and as far as I'm concerned, if they want to do them things, they would be easier to do under our own steam without having to, you know, follow EU guidelines.
You voted to leave, John. Are they right when they say, retrospectively, because they weren't saying it before the election, but are they right to say that this was actually all about Brexit, this election, and they underestimated that? Or do you think people just worried so much about Corbyn being a socialist and the socialist platform he stood on that it wasn't about Brexit at all, it was about just not having Corbyn?
I think it was a bit of both. I think it was the Brexit, and it was a very much anti-Corbyn. I think it's also become, because of the 2017 election, where they, you know, pledged that they would, you know, not hold up the Brexit exit of the EU, and they clearly have. I just think the trust went. I think the message was completely skewed. Because he's trying to sort of please the Labour Party membership, which are Remain, and Labour Party voters, a lot of which are Leave. And by trying to keep both happy, he's certainly lost the voters.
Do you think he left it too late to come up with a stance? Because I wonder as well, and I say this as a Ramona in chief on this station, I'm almost going to put that on my tombstone, Talk Radio is a Ramona in chief. But I also wonder if I would have found his stance about wanting a second referendum or whatever much more credible had he said it straight after the referendum. But for me, it felt like he was hedging his bets for too long and trying to please both Leave and Remain. And then by the time 3.5 years along, he came up with some sort of credible stance. Firstly, I didn't really believe it. And secondly, everyone was so sick of it that they didn't, the thought of actually going back with another referendum. I mean, I think if he was going to come up with a second referendum, it should have been 2017, he was saying that, not 2019.
Yeah, I agree. And the fact that a lot of people, you know, it's common knowledge that Jeremy Corbyn's personal views, if it was up to him personally, he would have us out of the EU.
Well, you've got the most strange situation at the moment, where you've got a Labour leader saying that we should have a second referendum who is actually a secret Leaver, and you've got a Tory leader who's Prime Minister who's been a Remainer all his life and is only advocating Leave because he knew it would make things better for him in the Tory party, because Boris is a Remainer. I mean, it's hilarious.
It's the strangest thing. But it's a case of, if you like, giving the people what they want, and the people he's chose to try and please are the people that have put him in power rather than the people that would keep him in power.
No, that's such a good point, John, and I really appreciate that. You're quite right. And again, I think that ties into the accusations of anti-Semitism as well, because whilst perhaps there is an argument that Jeremy Corbyn himself isn't, he was, in my opinion, perhaps happy to let it slide for a bit too long because he knew the very people that were acting in such an awful way were the very people keeping him there. So I don't think, at the very least, that makes him guilty by association, in my opinion. But again, as always, really appreciate you telling me why I'm wrong, telling me why you agree or disagree. And on that subject as well, we'll be talking a little bit more about how you cope with feeling lonely and whether you're someone yourself that has an issue with loneliness. Coming up, really exciting, we're going to be talking to Dame Esther Ranson. She's the founder of The Silver Line, and that's a way that older people can connect with each other who are feeling loneliness. We'll find out what she's got to say about this story and about this guy whose video has gone viral. And coming up as well, we might talk as well about a really uplifting story about grief that I think is going to, again, if you've lost someone, make you feel a little bit warm and fuzzy inside. I hope so. So all of that coming up. It's Christo here on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Christo Fufas on Talk Radio.
Good evening. Christo here with The Late Show with you till 1 o'clock here on Talk Radio. How are you? Thank you very much indeed for your company tonight. Lots we've been talking about. Coming up, we'll talk about Star Wars. Because the premiere took place last night, today it's going to be released everywhere, tomorrow it's going to be released everywhere, well in an hour, then there are some midnight screenings taking place. Do you love it? Do you loathe it? Do you get it? Do you understand why people are so passionate and obsessive about it? Why do you feel like you own that franchise and you get so angry if there's a part of it that you don't like? So we'll talk about that a little later. We've also been talking about the ideology of socialism and why you rejected the Labour Party at the last election, whether there's ever going to be an appetite for socialism back in the UK. But also, the other story that we've been turning our attention to this evening is that of loneliness. And we've been discussing the viral video of a gentleman who put a video on LinkedIn. A British man by the name of Mark Gaisford, a CEO from Kent. He's 52 years of age. He's the boss of a lot of younger people at work. And he put a video on LinkedIn saying how lonely he was. And how, you know, when you reach that age, you know, a lot of those younger guys and girls who go to the pub in their 20s, they're off entertaining. Perhaps older people, he doesn't really feel like he's in that category yet. And he doesn't really have any friends. And it's gone viral, especially for its bravery. So we've been talking about the concept of loneliness and how you, whether you feel lonely, whether this time of year really brings loneliness into focus, because of course you see all those people going off to parties and buying presents for all different kinds of people, and perhaps as well some positive ways in which you can feel better about feeling lonely. Now, you'll recognise my next guest. She actually turned television journalism, I think, into television campaigning, whether it be from her show That's Life, where she took issues like Ben Hardwick and the illness that he faced. I remember watching her on That's Life, and she was campaigning about motorway barriers. I remember that campaign because people were hitting them with their cars and they weren't secured deeply enough. She then founded Childline, which of course has helped millions of children. And now she's turned her attention to older people who face loneliness by founding the Silver Line. I am, of course, talking about Dame Esther Ranson, who joins me live on the line. Good evening to you, Esther.
Hi, Chris.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us tonight. We know we've actually met. I produced the Loose Women show where you came on to talk about the anniversary of Diana. I don't know if you remember.
I do.
So it was lovely to talk to you again. And of course, we're discussing loneliness and this video. I mean, firstly, were you surprised when you heard about this story that actually it wasn't an older person that you perhaps traditionally think of as lonely, but actually a man who's only 52 years of age actually admitting this?
Well, it is difficult to admit, I know, because there's a real stigma attached to loneliness. You know, people think, well, if you haven't got friends, if you haven't got family, if you haven't got company, maybe there's something wrong with you. So it's quite difficult to admit to it, but I think it can strike every age. I mean, I know that my daughter told me when she was, her son was a toddler and she'd take him to the playground. And she loved him dearly, but he was the only company she had. And she'd be standing there wishing that there was a friend that she could be, you know, taking her little boy out with, because just having the conversation of a toddler all day, every day is not enough. So I do think we're in an odd time in our society where we seem to be more connected than ever with technology, but less connected than ever with friends and family. We've got to do something about it.
Actually, you're really right, because obviously I was quite surprised to hear a gentleman of this age saying that. But again, when I was at Loose Women, we used to cover a lot of stories about young mums. Actually, I seem to remember Kate Middleton talking a bit about it as well, about how she felt quite isolated. And again, you would never expect someone like Kate Middleton, who's surrounded by all these people and all this, you know, wealth and extravagance and courtiers and all this stuff, but actually saying as a young mum, she felt really lonely as well, at a time where you just wouldn't expect it.
Absolutely, and I think that's why the NCT, the National Childbirth Trust, is so useful. I mean, personally, I think their attitude to childbirth is rather odd, because I remember my daughter used to go to class and then come back and tell me that she was going to open like a lotus blossom. I said, if so, she'd be the only woman giving birth to open like a lotus blossom, and some lotus blossom. But the great point about it was that she met a group of young women like herself, all expecting a baby at the same time, and they've been firm friends ever since. And I think sometimes it's really useful to join some sort of club or association for older people if you're well enough and you've got your health and strength and can get out and about. U3A is very useful because there again you can find people, even if they've got different kinds of tastes from you, you can enjoy their company. And the other great thing about U3A is that it does actually encourage you to think of older people as a resource, because the people who are holding the courses and classes are actually older people, volunteers, who just have a life experience and a lot of skill. Whereas we do think, or older people tell me, people treat them as if they're past their sell-by date.
Well, what's interesting about what this gentleman is saying in his video is that come Sunday night, I'm as miserable as sin and sick to death of the sound of my own thoughts. You know, what I would give to call up a mate and ask if he fancied a pie and a pint. And that he went on to talk about how he moved away due to meeting his wife and didn't go to university. And I guess, do you think that people at every age should almost plan for potential loneliness when they're older? Because it's true, maybe when you meet a partner, when you're in the throes of young children and you are with a partner and you're not feeling that loneliness then, that you might never think you will. So maybe you do abandon friendships, maybe you do let friendships fall by the wayside, when in actual fact maybe we should all be, I don't know, having a loneliness pension when we're older.
I remember going to a meeting held by Relate, you know, the marriage charity that helps couples that are splitting up. And somebody had done a survey into loneliness and said the crucial thing that you must remember is that you're going to need your friends and family more and more as you get older. So don't get so absorbed in your job or your particular nuclear family to the extent that you break the links that you have had in the past, because you are going to need them. And I think that's really important to remember, that these relationships become more important as you get older, not less.
It's true. And when you're younger as well, and I've noticed this, you sort of, again, I think it's a sign of age, but you have sort of petty fallings out with people, or things that people say or do, they seem like such a big deal at the time. And then when you were older, you would shrug it off. And again, I think maybe we need to all think along the lines that these people won't be around forever. And actually to fall out over something stupid is ridiculous, because when you're older, you'll need these people.
I think that's right. I was talking to someone today and saying just that. Maybe as you get older, you do learn to prioritize what is important and you become more tolerant. I certainly learned how to smile and nod and smile and nod, even if I disagreed, because actually the person I was talking to is more important than the topic that we happen to disagree about. I mean, my two closest friends, we disagree completely about Brexit, totally. So what we've learned to do is not discuss it.
Yeah, and smile sweetly, as you say, and nod. God, the amount of times we all have to do that. And I imagine working in television for many years, you made that a fine art, because you have to do that quite a lot in that industry. Do you think loneliness is also a frame of mind that you can actually change your mindset? Because I don't know if you heard what I was saying earlier, but I was reading a piece by a journalist by the name of Matt Bagwell, and he was petrified a few years ago about spending Christmas on his own because of circumstances. He'd broken up with a partner, but now he chooses to, and that's his day. And he absolutely loves the fact that he's sort of breaking the mold and doing that. And he's learned to appreciate that that is his day. And do you think that maybe having that more positive frame of mind about loneliness is a good strategy?
I certainly think there's a real difference between being alone and being lonely. I had a friend who lived alone, and he really enjoyed his own company. And I admired him, because I've never enjoyed mine, for obvious reasons. But I do think that if you are alone, particularly over Christmas, and you hate it, maybe you have just broken up with somebody close to you, or, you know, there are other circumstances, look around for volunteering opportunities, because if you find a cause you care about, a friend of mine who had just separated spent the first two or three Christmases on his own, helping out in a local charity that offered lunch to people who were on their own, maybe sleeping rough, maybe homeless. And they were the best Christmases of his life, because he came away with a real feeling of achievement and having met people who shared his interests. So there are lots of ways of volunteering. The RVS is a wonderful organization offering all kinds of volunteering opportunities. If you have a disability, the Silver Line, all you have to do is listen to people on the phone and give them a feeling that they're valued and that you would like to be a friend of theirs. So, I mean, look around, look up your local council website, because that's got a list of all the local projects. And I'm sure if you're on your own for the first time or on your own and hating it, just see how many people would really value your help as a resource. And at the end of the day, I bet you enjoy it.
Did that help you? Because obviously, when you lost your partner of many, many years, did the fact that you are out there campaigning and trying to make people's lives better, did you find that that was a comfort for you?
I think, like many widows, I have filled my life with working in the voluntary sector. And it has given me a sense of achievement, made me meet people with great skills, talk to people who are far worse off than I am, and it does restore your sense of perspective, and it brings you into contact with people of every age, which is, I think, really good for you. So, but don't overdo it. My kids say I overdo it. They sit down with me and say, Mother, will you please stop spending your day with people you don't care about as much as you care about us?
Do you think that they will ever listen to their advice, Dame Esther? Do you think ever you'll say, you know what, yeah, that's it, I'm going to stop, I'm going to put my feet up?
Well, I had a very funny conversation with my PA, because I said to her, I think I'm going to try and just do one thing a day. And she just looked at me and laughed.
Even I know that's not true, and I'm not your PA, and even I know that's a load of rubbish.
It is very difficult. But I do take the point that when you reach the age I'm at, which is 80 next summer,
wow,
you do have to bear in mind you're not going to be there forever. And if you want to spend time with your grandchildren, you have to prioritise it and plan for it.
The Silver Line, obviously you take calls from, well, is it anyone that can call the Silver Line, or is there a particular age bracket? What is the story, and what are the typical kinds of calls you get?
Well, we tend to say, if you think that it's for you, then it is for you, because there's that word silver in the title, and that implies, I suppose, 55 plus, but we don't have an absolute rule about it. Most people who ring us are talking to us about loneliness and haven't got anybody else at all to have a conversation with. It's really sad how many people live on their own and for all kinds of different circumstances, often disability or because they're a carer or for other reasons, really don't have anybody that they can just chat to, share a memory with, share a joke with.
Share something on the telly. Laugh at something on the telly with someone.
Absolutely. What did you think about Strictly? Did you think the right person won, Christo?
Did I? Well, actually, I mean, look, I'll be honest with you, Dame Esther. I do watch it. I know you did it as well, and that was one of the brilliant ways you were getting out there to do stuff. But I want to do that show so badly that it's actually become painful for me to watch it. I know that it sounds ridiculous, but because I don't think I'll ever have the profile to be asked. But Kelvin was absolutely brilliant, and I won't lie, I did start to get a little bit obsessed with his hip swivel, which I'm not sure I'm allowed to admit on the radio, but I suppose it is 24 minutes to midnight, so if I can't say it now, I can't say it any time. What about you?
Well, this is the kind of thing that we talk about. You know, yeah. Actually, people ring us up in the middle of the night feeling a sudden pang of loneliness and talking about something that may not be very important, but you've got a view about and you enjoy sharing views, even if you disagree with them. I didn't really enjoy Kelvin's hips much. But then I'm a great fan of Anton, so you see I'm a bit prejudiced on this.
Of course, because you know he was your partner when you were on, right?
He was.
It would have been, I mean, I loved Emma Barton, by the way. She's great, but it's a shame if he is going to stand down, as we were saying he might do, then it would be a shame that he's not done it as a winner, because he does deserve to win one year.
Don't worry, he's not. That is an idle rumour put about by someone who hasn't got enough to write about in his newspaper. Because I actually have remained a friend of Anton's. He's forgiven me for my dancing. And I said to him, what's all this about you giving up? And he said, it is completely untrue. Obviously, there will come a time, I suppose, when producers will think, well, you know, maybe someone new, or he'll think, I want to do something else, but that time hasn't come yet. So hopefully we will see Anton again.
And winning as well. On that subject, because it's interesting you bring up that, you know, talking about TV shows, talking about this kind of thing. To what extent is the television important for older, lonely people? Because there's been a lot of talk about the TV license and it remaining free for certain people. Do you feel that that's an important tool for older people? And what do you think about the plans for the TV license?
It's definitely a necessity. For a lot of people, it's the only company they have. Particularly if you have a disability and you literally cannot get out of your house, and maybe you have carers, but they come and go so fast they can't afford to stay, have a cup of tea, share a joke with you. So that's why people on television become, well, your friends in your mind, because they're so real and they are the only company you have. So I think the television license is not a luxury for people who, as they get older, cannot get out and about meeting other people. I think it's a necessity.
And what do you think about this idea that so clearly you're very much against the BBC perhaps potentially saying that they're going to have over 75s pay for it?
Well, the problem is that it's very, very expensive now. It's losing them a lot of income at a time where they're competing with things like Netflix, who are spending billions on their very high-quality drama, and the BBC is trying to compete. So I think the fancy footwork done by the government to push it onto the BBC's shoulders as their responsibility, and, you know, so the government could save money, but they didn't get the blame if they couldn't afford it. So I think, personally, I think if the BBC said that they were prepared to pay for people who were in a particular tax bracket, which meant that they really are quite hard up, if the BBC can cover that cost, let the government pick up all the rest.
Well, maybe they've just hired, you'll have seen in the news, June Sarpong as someone to look into the diversity, both off and on screen at the BBC. Maybe they should hire you, Dame Esther, to make sure that older people are well represented, both on and off screen, and make sure that everything is good for them as well, because I think you've raised some really important points. Merry Christmas. Where are you spending Christmas? Just final question.
With my family, with my extended family, because my sister's coming over from Australia, so lots of nieces and nephews, as well as my grandchildren and my children. So it's a lovely time, as long as they all get on well together. Fingers crossed.
Well, you make sure you have a day off as well. Just one
day. I certainly will. And Merry Christmas to all your listeners and to you, Christo.
Thank you.
And have a very happy time. And don't forget, if you are on your own and you are the Silver Generation, 0800 4 70 80 90. It's easy to remember. 0800 is free. Who's it for? It's for 70 80 90, and we'll be there throughout Christmas and the new year.
Wonderful. Dame Esther Ranson, thank you so much. The founder of the Silver Line, campaigner, and well, I don't need to tell you everything that Dame Esther Ranson has done. What did you make of that? What did you make of her points? What did you make about her strategies for being lonely? How important the TV is, how important it is to chat to other people. 0344 499 1000 is the number to call. We've got a few calls coming in on this, as well as some of the tweets as well that you want to share. And then coming up, we're going to be talking about, well, you'll never be lonely if you're a Star Wars fan over the next few days, will you? Because that's all anyone is going to be talking about. And you'll be telling me why. Sell me your obsession with this franchise, or indeed any other massive movie franchise. We'll talk about that as well. That's all coming up. It's Christo here on Talk Radio.
Christo Fufas on Talk Radio.
Good evening. Sorry, I just punched the microphone, not deliberately. I know I was a bit of fangirling there over Dame Esther Anson, but I mean, she's someone I've watched on telly for my entire life. And, you know, she's clearly an amazing woman who's campaigning not only for children, but now for older people with the Silver Line. And I guess she's doing everything she can to solve the problem of loneliness. How surprised are you to hear about this video? Should we hear a clip of it again, actually? This is the gentleman, a 52-year-old guy. The video's gone viral, and that's because on LinkedIn, he's a CEO of a company, and people are amazed that this guy, who seemingly has it all, you know, really good job, you know, he's the boss of a company, he's got children, you know, on paper, he's got everything, but he's actually really, really lonely.
Well, I have no friends. It's a scary thing to admit that, you know, especially here on LinkedIn. But it's true. I know a lot of people, but it's mostly through networking and work and everything to do with work. I'm really lucky because I've got some amazing work colleagues, and you know, naturally we share our lives with each other, so we share what's going on. But, you know, I don't take them out for dinner, and I don't go on long country walks with them. I don't do stuff with them that friends do. It's not just me as well who's got no friends. There are a staggering number of people, and mostly men, across the UK who've got very few, if any, people, friends, that they can actually talk about any sort of serious stuff with. And it's a tough one, isn't it? Because, you know, you don't want to be the sad, lonely git that admits to having no friends, but I haven't.
So, I mean, that's pretty staggering stuff, isn't it, that someone would admit to that? I don't know if you find it quite amazing, but I do. And it's really made me think as well, because I'm a man in my 40s, early 40s, thank you. I'm just saying. And I've got to an age where, especially as a lot of my friends have children, that once they became parents, I quite consciously, it became far more difficult to ring up my friends for a chat. You know, when friends have got kids, you can't spend half an hour on the phone talking complete rubbish with them. So you stop doing it. You stop calling your friend. You might call your friend to say, right, you know, are we meeting here? Or you'll go on WhatsApp and arrange to meet them, and then you'll have a great chat when you meet them. And I'm very lucky, extremely lucky. I've got friends that I've had for 25 years from university, and I spent today with two of them. Traditionally, every year we go to the Southwark Carols and then go to Borough Market and have a few glasses of wine and a lunch, and we do that every single year. And I'm really lucky that I've got friends like that, but I don't ring them for a chat. It's really rare that I ring my mother for a chat. Well, I say I ring my mother. I mean, trying to get my mother F off the phone is unbelievable. And as I've got older, I'm not as good on the phone. I used to be able to spend hours on the phone. You ask my partner. Now, when he rings me, I'm literally, let's get off the phone. I'm not very good at it. I used to be brilliant at chatting on the phone. But I wonder if that's part of it as well, that when you're a teenager, you can spend hours on the phone talking absolute rubbish, analysing things to within an inch of their lives. But when you're older, you just stop doing that. And you feel a bit of a fool ringing a friend for a chat that you only spoke to a week ago. I might ring a friend for a chat that I've not spoken to for a couple of months, catch up, but I wouldn't just ring for a bull. I won't use the second word in that, but you know what I mean? Just to talk rubbish and just to go, you know, oh my God, did you see you on Strictly? And oh my word, and something happened to me today. Those sorts of catch-ups where you're actually talking about nothing. And I don't think as you get older, you do that as much. And I wonder whether that sort of ties into it. And then you lose touch with people, and that ties into all of why you might be feeling a little bit lonely. Now, by the way, there's a story about grief as well, which ties into this. Should we do that now? Should we bring that little bit in now? All right, I just want to tell you this story as well. Then we'll talk to Serge, who's in Oxford. But this is a really lovely story, and I think it will make you feel better. Because, again, at this time of year, if you're feeling a bit down, it might be because of the fact that it really brings into focus the people who aren't here, and the people you might have lost. I don't know if you saw the story about Embankment, the tube station. Do you know this story? So it went viral a few days ago. It was on one of the London websites. I think the Londonist might have got it. Now, have you ever wondered why, if you ever visit London from out of town, or if indeed you live in London, have you ever wondered why, you know, when you go to certain tube stations, and obviously they were, you know, built when we invented the wheel, so some of them aren't particularly well designed, and of course a lot of them are on corners and all this type of thing, so you end up with a gap, a really big gap between the tube station, tube train and the platform, right? So you've got the mind the gap sound. Now, shall we hear, well, let's hear the mind the gap sound. This is the normal, bog standard, across the network, mind the gap sound that you get on London Underground.
Mind the gap, please.
Okay, that's a very short clip of the new mind the gap. Let's hear the one now that you get at Embankment Station.
Mind the gap. Mind the gap. Mind the gap.
So, can you hear that they're slightly different? Now, the reason for that is because there was a woman, and her name is Margaret McCollum, and in 2012, I think around the time of the Olympics, they digitized the entire network when it came to announcements on London Underground, and they got rid of the voice that had originally done Mind the Gap. Now, Margaret McCollum was particularly upset when that happened because she used to go and listen to that particular Mind the Gap voice, the second one, in Embankment Station. She used to sit there, let the trains go by and listen. Why? Because it was her husband's voice, and her husband had died. So when she turned up one day and it was a different voice, she was absolutely devastated. So Transport for London, they basically went through the archives, restored the original voice, digitized it so that it would fit in with the new system, and that is why the voice you hear at Embankment Tube Station, which is an actor by the name of Oswald Lawrence, that's why it's a different voice at Embankment, because they reinstated his voice at Embankment because it helped with her grief that his voice was heard. And that's why there's a different voice at Embankment than everywhere else on the network to tell you to mind the gap. Isn't that a lovely story? In the sea of misery and hell and Brexit and rubbish and politics and Boris and lies and Jeremy Corbyn, isn't that really, really nice? And actually, I will tear apart Transport for London for everything, but what a lovely thing to do. So, obviously, this time of year will be the time of year. She probably, at Christmas, is one of the times where she's sitting on the platform the most to listen to that voice. So that's what we're discussing, grief. And indeed, how you manage to get over it. And of course, whether this time of year is a time where you feel a little bit lonely. And Serge is in Oxford and has given us a call on that. Hi there, Serge.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
Fine, thank you. What was it that you wanted to call about? Because it was loneliness that prompted you to pick up the phone, right?
I've got my parents in London, lives in Hammersmith, and my father is amazing. He's an amazing guy. I give him all the bless he needs, but fortunately I ran away from him, and I pack up all my bags, and I went to my next door neighbor, and then since then I since like 6 years now, going to seven. I on and off go and see them, but I just want to be out of there.
So was it quite a negative relationship you had with your parents?
If you put that way, yes. Okay. Yes. And, you know, I'm on my middle 40s now, and, you know, I haven't spent Christmas with them for 6 years, and I am finding, at the moment I'm working in Oxford, it's an amazing place, and at the moment I'm living by myself. Always we have people in and out living in our place, but fortunately, in every day, I all by myself, grieving Christmas, you know, I work with my chef. My chef is a great guy, trying to make me happy, but this is not what I want to be. So,
okay, and do you sometimes feel lonely living in Oxford?
Yeah,
on
I
your
do.
Own?
Yes, I do all the time. That's why, you know, I go out. You know, it's an amazing place in Wantage. In Wantage is the Berlin. I go there, I meet people, but fortunately the people I meet there, they're all full of, they are scumbags, if my say. They're all after money. You know, I've been
Where are they scumbags?
Eh?
Where did you say they were scumbags?
In Wantage Marketplace.
Oh, all right.
Absolutely. People with no money, people with no...
Well, I mean, is a marketplace the right place to be sort of going to meet new people?
To be honest with you, I've thought that and I keep going back and back and back and back and I keep saying to myself, no, I'm not going there tomorrow, I'm not going there the next day. Guess what I'm doing? I am there.
Why are you going to Wantage Market?
The thing is, I met this amazing... Mother has nearly two kids now, and she's, you know, she's.
you're going back hoping to bump into someone that you've met previously, right?
Yeah, obviously right. I shouldn't do that, which is my biggest mistake I did.
She have your number, or do you have hers?
Well, I've deleted, and I've done a few things tonight while I was listening to your show. And I've listened to a lot of people in your show. It's like I used to listen to sports. Right. Now, one of my colleagues said, listen, go to talk radio. And I went to talk radio. It makes my life really different.
But we're happy, really. That we're happy that it does, and we're happy that it gives you some company. But I would say that maybe going to look for someone who... you're not in touch with anymore, who perhaps, does this person know how to contact you?
She does, but she keeps sending me Facebook all that with a kid on that, blah, blah, blah. But
where you are, my love, then, and she's not perhaps contacting you, then maybe it's not meant to be, and maybe you going back and continually looking for her is actually just damaging your mental health, because you're going back, and when you don't find her, you're then feeling bad, and then you're coming home, and that probably knocks your confidence about going and looking for someone else, and you end up in this cycle where, I don't know, I'm just offering you some ideas, but...
Yeah, you're absolutely right, you know, trying to get away from me, yes. Which I will do that, that's why I'm calling you guys tonight, so I called tonight, and I spoke to your assistants, and I've made my decision today, is to give up everything, basically give up alcohol, give up seeing stupid people you don't need to, like for example the person I just mentioned, and from tonight, which is 12 o'clock now, is my decision to make, you know, what's best for me, not for them.
And is that your solution to get over loneliness?
Yes, it is.
All right, well, all I'll say, and I say this with love, Serge, and I say this with years of experience of doing this, having resolutions is a great thing, but I would always say, and again, I'm not trained, I'm not a psychologist or anything like that, I'm just a friend really, but I would always say, as someone who has lived a life of making resolutions that are really extreme, I'm giving up food, I'm giving up alcohol, I'm giving up everything, it's really difficult to do that in one go, and when then you fail, which I'm not saying you will, but sometimes when you make a really big resolution, it's really difficult to stick to it. So I wonder whether maybe you'd be better off with a few more baby steps, you know, maybe cut down on your booze with the view of giving it up eventually. Maybe cut down on doing some of the negative things. I mean, maybe your first step should be to stop keeping going back to that market and maybe make a resolution to go somewhere else first, rather than trying to say, right, I'm not going to do this, not going to do that, and I'm going to completely change my life in 1 minute and 20 seconds time, which is what you're saying, maybe you're on the right track by having and recognizing the things that are negative for you, but doing it all in one go might be a bit much and might mean that you're not as successful as you could be.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. So, like you said, it won't be able to happen from one minute to the other. So I need to give myself at least a month, you know, and then I will, you know, I'll call you guys back and then see how I'm going from there, because I really cannot live in this sort of life that people just treat you like a scumbag. you know, and I'm not going to have that anymore. So,
all right, well, sir, and I think that's good. If you know that there are things in your life that are making you feel worse and making you feel lonely, and there are things you are doing that are helping that, maybe drinking a bit too much and all those things, then fair play to you, because you're taking action and you're going to do things that are going to make you happier. And that's ultimately what you want to do. All I'll say is just steps, do it in steps rather than doing it so quickly. But I wish you the best of luck, my love, and give us a call back sometime and tell us how you're getting on, because of course we'd love to hear from you here on Talk Radio. In the next hour, we'll continue this conversation and we'll also talk about, well, the force and whether it really is with you. It certainly was with many people in Leicester Square last night, because you'll be telling me why you love or loathe Star Wars next here on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Christo Fufas on Talk Radio.
Morning all. 4 minutes past midnight. It's Christo with your late show till 1 o'clock here on Talk Radio. Lots that we've been discussing. We've been talking about socialism earlier. I don't know whether we'll continue that conversation. I'm not sure there's anything left that we can say about it other than we're not sure we love it. But of course, if you want to call about whether socialism will ever be really popular again here in the UK and why it is that we seem to reject it so much, 0344 499 1000. We've been talking about loneliness as well, and whether you're someone that this time of year really feels it, and whether you are able to, like our last caller, come up with positive ways in which you can challenge it. This hour we're going to talk about Star Wars as well. I don't know if you saw, but can we play the theme actually under me while we're talking about this? I mean, it is one of the most amazing film scores of all time. Is from music soundtrack. It's John Williams, isn't it, that did Star Wars. Do you know, it's one of the few music scores I've ever bought. I'm not talking about soundtracks, but I think the music of all the Star Wars movies are just phenomenal. And you know that each character has their own theme. So during certain fight scenes, if there are certain characters, they have their own certain theme that is brought in. Utterly amazing. And of course last night the Rise of Skywalker got its premiere. Now we've got someone who's seen it in about 10 minutes time. John Hearn is going to be coming in, maybe 15, and telling us whether it's any good or whether it really isn't. Because of course they've got it wrong on a few of them, haven't they? Now, episode 4 was the first one that was ever released, which is of course A New Hope. Then you've got The Empire Strikes Back, which at the moment I actually think rates as probably one of my favourite out of all of them. Then you've got Return of the Jedi, which again is brilliant. The Ewoks, 1984, was when that was released. I remember that when I was a little boy watching that in the cinema and being so excited about Ewoks. I think I had a little plastic Ewok, and I had a little, you know, that was when merchandise was getting really massive. Then obviously there was the huge gap. Then we got the prequels. Now, the first one was The Phantom Menace. Now, I don't mean to be funny, but that was rubbish. It was, wasn't it? You know, it was a great concept, but it was so rubbish. And, of course, Jar Jar Binks, which I think managed to be racist, homophobic, sexist. It managed to offend pretty much everyone, that character. So they didn't really like that one. Then, of course, the second one was Attack of the Clones. Again, that was a bit dull, that one. I mean, I do think it's important to watch them to get the context. The third one, which was, of course, now, again, I'm doing all this from memory, Return of the Sith, Revenge of the Sith. That was good. I really liked that one. And by then, as well, Hayden Christensen, who played Anakin Skywalker, had actually learned how to act. Because in the second one, oh my word, the acting was terrible in all of them. And of course, they then procreated together and had Luke Skywalker. And as it turns out, I don't think it's a massive spoiler, turns out Princess Leia was Luke Skywalker's sister. That they only met at A New Hope at that point. But of course they were going to gravitate together because they've got the Force and the Jedi and all of that. But I mean, it is a brilliant, brilliant story. I love it's sort of like this massive space saga and an odyssey which had never really been done properly before. I mean, a bit of a strange one because, of course, Anakin Skywalker went to the dark side, and that was why they had to get Luke Skywalker away from him. And, of course, Luke Skywalker, I think, was eventually raised by Jimmy Smits from L.A. Law. That was the actor that played the people that raised him. But you can't help but think, well, hang on. Darth Vader, I mean, they used the same surname. They knew his name was Skywalker, so why didn't they change his name? So there's a big, big plot hole there. Then we got The New Hope. Then we got, like I said, Empire Strikes Back. Then we got Return of the Jedi. Then we got... Now, what was the seventh one? The something Jedi. It was something Jedi. The Force Awakens. Force Awakens. Then there was the eighth one, which was The Last Jedi. Now, I enjoyed The Last Jedi, but a lot of people got really annoyed because they thought it was a lot of box ticking. And they thought that actually some of the characters that were in it were just in it because of the diversity rather than because they were actually decent characters, because there were other characters that could have been used. And now, and Daisy Ridley can't act to save her life. I mean, why do they put such bad actors in it? Daisy, am I wrong to say that Daisy Ridley is a terrible, terrible actor? Honestly. And now we've got The Rise of Skywalker. But since then as well, we've got some of the other ones that have spun off, because there was Rogue One. And then there was also, which I really enjoyed. And again, this is from memory. It's the one where it's the young Han Solo. I think it's just called Solo, isn't it? Solo, A Star Wars Story. That, I really enjoyed that. I thought that was brilliant. And that was where he first met Chewbacca. And do you know what? I saw one of those countdown shows. Even our very own talk radio's Kevin O'Sullivan was on the other day. And did you see the Christmas Nightmare countdown show? And they showed in that the 1977 Star Wars Christmas special. And it was a TV special that they produced, like an hour and a half long Christmas special just for TV, that they produced to promote the film. And they didn't think the film was going to do that well, so they all kind of agreed to it. It's one of the most diabolical things. If you are a Star Wars fan and you watch it, it will shatter everything. So the story is that it's a sort of little side story just for Christmas. I mean, are you a Star Wars fan? Yeah, so I'll go on YouTube and watch this. It will make you fall on your floor laughing. So they decided as a Christmas special that they'd do the side plot. But, of course, they didn't have the money for the set or for anything else. So you've got... and the story was that Chewbacca needed to get home for Christmas. So you've got Mrs. Chewbacca in her house and the two little Chewbacca children. And Mrs. Chewbacca is watching a cookery show, trying to make all the Christmas pudding and the turkey and everything. And Han Solo in the Millennium Falcon has got to get him back for Christmas. But of course, the Millennium Falcon, they don't have the set for it. So it's literally like Han Solo and Chewbacca in a room, like with a couple of buttons behind them, because they can't afford to make it look like the Millennium Falcon. And Beatrice Arthur, now she's an actress that was in The Golden Girls. She plays like a barmaid in it. Diane Carroll, who is a very famous singer, she's in it, and she's in some sort of dream sequence. It's so bad. It's so bad. I think Carrie Fisher afterwards said that, you know, that she wants it to be consigned to the dustbin of history. It's on YouTube. People have found, because I think they tried when Star Wars got famous and Star Wars got really big, they tried to get rid of it. And but people have found copies and put it on YouTube. It will ruin Star Wars forever for you, watching Chewbacca and Mrs. Chewbacca. It's really bad. So anyway, those are your Star Wars. So, you know, you can tell I'm quite into it. I am quite into Star Wars, and I do love watching them, and I did love watching the three together, and I do love revisiting it every couple of years, because I think that those sorts of things, you can't watch them too often, because they lose their appeal. But I do love it, and I'm really interested to see what they've come up with the Rise of Skywalker. Now, I know on Rotten Tomatoes at the moment, it's about 53% it's on, so it's not amazing. And are they going to be able to, as this is part nine, resolve the whole thing and that be that? And also, I'm not sure I believe this is part nine. I think that they will. I think in a few years' time, they'll come up with something else. What I think it's been lacking is this, is a thread. Like, who is Rey? Like, and what has John Boyega got to do with anything? Like, we still don't know. And Oscar Isaac, who works for the Resistance, like, who is he? And why is there, and also, I thought at the end of Return of the Jedi, they'd killed everyone that was bad and that was it. So where's the new Emperor come from? I mean, maybe I missed that, but I don't think there's enough explanations of the plot. And if you haven't got a good plot, I don't think you've got anything. What have we got here? I saw Rogue One on telly the other night. Oh, have you deleted my loneliness text? I just had a really good loneliness one as well. Can you put that back on, please? I saw Rogue One on the telly the other night, and it was far better than I expected. I also like the Family Guy and Robot Chicken spoofs. Oh, I'd like to see that. Oh, I love this. When we were talking about loneliness before, there was a really long text. I think it was from someone called Sheila, maybe. Don't touch my screen. Fiddling around with it. What do you mean you no longer? When in the last hour I was talking about loneliness and I was saying it's really difficult just to ring people up and shoot the breeze and just chat rubbish to them. When you get older, you don't really do that. What do you mean you no longer get the chance to talk, chat bullshine with people? It's what you do now. It's your job. You're right. Thank you. Another one here, saying I'm 55 and have lived on my own for 12 years after a life lived and many relationships. Loneliness is a state of mind. It can range from having no friends or family through to having many family and friends and everything in between. We are all psychological creatures, and sometimes it's about not wanting to engage with the world. But everyone should have people somewhere to be able to go and be a part of something, says Mal in Belfast. Well, again, I think you raise a really good point there, Mal, because maybe when you're lonely because you know you don't have anyone to actually call. You might choose to be alone, and that's your choice. Like, sometimes in my life, I've chosen to be alone, chosen to spend a lot of time on my own, but I've always known I've got someone I could call if I wanted to, and that's the difference between being lonely and being alone. Interesting, Mal. Thank you very much indeed for that one. There's a short fictional film, which I think is called Mind the Gap, and it's based upon the story of the lady that I was talking about at the end of the last hour. And it's a lovely film. You should check it out if you get the chance. I will do indeed. We'll be telling you whether you should bother checking out this latest edition of Star Wars. But I want to know from you, what is the appeal of this franchise? Why do you feel like you own it so much? Because the last movie, it didn't do so well. I think it did well in the box office, but it didn't do so well with reviews. People were furious. I mean, there was a petition saying, refilm it, reshoot the whole thing. Like, they're going to do that. Like, they're going to say, yeah, all right, we'll just scrap it. People were utterly, utterly fuming that they didn't feel it had been done well enough. So what are those big movie franchises that you love? And are there any as well that have perhaps dated a little bit? Like, for me as well, the one that I grew up with, and I love it so much, is Superman. And I'm not talking about the modern Superman, Henry Cavill. Sorry, just that name. Just give me a moment, because he is a very, very, very handsome man. Very handsome. I've actually got a little bit of a wager on him being the next James Bond. If they do another James Bond, I think he'd be brilliant. I'm not talking about Brandon Routh as Superman. I'm talking about the early 80s, Christopher Reeve, Margot Kidder as Lois Lane, Marlon Brando was in those ones as well, and Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor. I mean, that is my Superman, and that franchise, I lived and breathed it when I was little. I couldn't wait for the next one. And then Superman 2, where he flies off Niagara Falls. I mean, Lois Lane is really, really careless, right? Isn't she? Because he flew off, and it wasn't Lois Lane that fell off in Niagara Falls. You haven't got a clue what I'm talking about now, have you? No. Lois Lane, because she fell out of the helicopter in the first one and nearly died. Then she fell out of his arms when they were flying and nearly died. And then she was in the earthquake and nearly died. And then in the second one, she nearly got shot by a bullet and she nearly died. And the child fell off. I mean, it's a very accident-prone place, this metropolis. But when they were at Niagara Falls and a child fell off the railings and he flew down. I mean, I remember nearly peeing my pants watching that in the cinema. I was so excited. And now when you watch it back, it really is a bit ropey. It's a bit like Star Wars sometimes. When I watch, my partner's a millennial and I showed him the first Star Wars couple of years ago, and he was giggling. He was going, oh my God, this is like, the special effects are so unbelievably bad. But no, at the time, that spacecraft was flying through space. Christopher Reeve was flying through the air. So do you get it? And what are the ones where you feel the same? 0344 499 1000 is the number to call. When we'll be back, we'll be getting a review of the new Star Wars film. We might play a couple of clips of the original ones as well. And talking of movie soundtracks as well, maybe we'll play a bit of Indiana Jones as well, because that's another one that's got an amazing soundtrack. So all of that and more between now and 1 o'clock here on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Christo Fufas on Talk Radio.
Midnight. Good morning to you. It's Christo here on Talk Radio. It's your late show with you till 1 o'clock. How are you? We've been talking about music and films. We got into that realm because of the amazing Star Wars soundtrack. And of course, we might play a little bit of Indiana Jones between now and 1 o'clock. And of course, we are talking about Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, which took place last night. You've been telling me why it's such an important franchise, why it's one of those franchises that you feel like you own, and you get furious when it's not 100% right. Now, John Hearn, hello, film critic.
Hello, hi.
You've seen it.
I have, I saw it last night.
Okay, tell me anything yet.
Okay.
Because, should we play a clip of the new one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's play a clip of the new one, and then you can tell me whether you want to hear a clip of the original later, and maybe we'll compare and contrast. So this is a little trailer of the film that premiered last night. It's in cinemas today. It's the 9th and final installment, if we believe it's the final one, of the Star Wars story, The Rise of Skywalker.
They fly now! They fly now!
Confronting fear. It's the destiny of a Jedi.
It's okay that we're here.
It's okay that you're here.
It's good.
Does she do that to us?
So there we go. That's the trailer. You can't really tell much from it.
That's a tiny little clip.
The little tiny bit, and there are lots of funny noises from funny animals.
They're lightsabers.
Is it any good?
Oh, you come straight in with the question, don't you? No pandering, no chipping around it. Oh, crikey. Is it any good? I'm very mixed on it. I'm sorry.
Well, so is Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, yeah, I think it's 53%, I think Guardian gave it three stars out of five, which isn't terrible.
No, that's about right. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes, so it's not the longest Star Wars film. It's not the shortest Star Wars film, so it's kind of in the middle. It has a difficult job to try and tie up a 42-year franchise, a 9-movie franchise. I don't really count the two sort of side ones because they're not kind of part of the linear
thread. Why did they leave it to wrap it all up in the last one?
Well, because you kind of have to.
Yeah.
Is it any good? There certainly are great moments. The ending is brilliant. I really like the ending. The last sort of probably hour is fantastic. It does kind of feel like it's meandering towards it, and they sort of thought, well, we've got this great idea for the final hour, we just don't know how to get there. And so it sort of plods along quite a lot.
I mean, is it
to get to that point?
Is it the formula that, oh my word, with the resistance, it's all looking terrible for us, but actually if we manage to go and hit our gun on the certain part of the big base, then we're gonna win, and then we're gonna have a big fight at the end, and there'll be lots and lots of flying around, and then suddenly there'll be a whilst the big Death Star slash base slash everything is all falling apart. There'll be a lightsaber fight inside it as it's falling apart, and then it'll all get resolved at the end.
So you're the person who bought the script on eBay that John Boyega allegedly left under his bed and was stolen by the cleaner. Is that right?
Because what is just...
Because that's
that,
it.
That right. is...
That's it.
I mean, I found The Force Awakens to be essentially that story, didn't it? That at the end of it, they had to hit the, not the Death Star, but whatever it was at the time in the certain
Starkiller.
Place.
Yeah, the Starkiller base. Which actually was a kind of a copy of the original film, A New Hope, episode 4. Yeah, where they had to get the
shot down the exhaust. Because I was a bit annoyed by that, because I thought, well, hang on, you're presuming that it's all new viewers, when in actual fact, there are lots of people who watched A New Hope who will think, well, hang on, you just... It's not a it's a new hope, but it's not a new script.
No. Well, actually, the screening last night, I would say a disproportionate number of the audience were slightly overweight men in their 40s.
Okay. Which that would be me then.
Yeah, and myself probably.
Thank you.
That to me kind of said that most of the people who were going there were people who'd grown up with it as a kid. Because I grew up with it as a kid. I went to the cinema to see not the very first one, but the second one, The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. The first time I went to the cinema to see them. So I grew up with them. I had the action figures as a kid.
Same here.
And I was, I absolutely loved the original Star Wars trilogy. I went to the cinema to see the George Lucas remakes of the original three, which aren't great. And I can see why he did it, but at the same time, they're not the Star Wars that I remember. And I went to the cinema to see
there were touches in that where they replaced the actor that played Jabba the Hutt with the Jabba the Hutt.
Well, because in the original idea, they did shoot a scene with Jabba the Hutt as being like a human
yes.
character, and then cut that entire scene out. And then when they came to do the Return of the Jedi, they brought the character back but turned him into this giant slug thing. So when they wanted to put that scene back in, they couldn't put him back in as a human. So they had to put him back in as a slug. And so it caused all sorts.
There's a famous thing where Harrison Ford walks around him, and they have to make out that he walks over the tail.
And the CG's terrible, and it looks awful. So there's things like that I didn't really like. And then I went to see the original trilogy. The prequel trilogy, which is 20 years ago now. The first one, that Phantom Menace. And like everybody else, just thought, what on earth is this nonsense? This isn't Star Wars.
It doesn't actually relate at all. There's no... Whereas the episode 7 almost was too much of a carbon copy of A New Hope, episode 1 bore no relation to it whatsoever.
Well, I've been thinking about this and trying to work out why. And I think it's because in the original trilogy, episodes 4, 5 and 6, it's very, very clearly defined. Good and bad. It's a battle between the dark side of the Force and the light side of the Force. The dark side of the Force of Darth Vader, who dresses in black, I mean, it's fairly obvious, against Luke Skywalker, the good guy, who dresses in slightly off-white. Okay? I mean, you can't get any more clearer than that. Okay? And the whole story and all the other characters are just there to proliferate this story of good versus evil played out between these two characters, who we learn in the second film in the original trilogy have a strong connection. That is also then played out again in this new franchise, in this new trilogy. Only this time, the good and bad are Kylo Ren, who is Darth Vader's grandson, and that's not giving anything away. We know that.
No,
very
we
early
knew that
on.
Already because he had the old and mask and the
yeah,
the
it's very early on in that film. And
can we
then,
say whose children he is?
Because that's an integral part of the first film of this new trilogy. Yeah,
he is the child of Princess Leia and
Han Solo.
And Han Solo. Yeah. And we never really find out why, but he becomes slightly obsessed with his grandfather.
Yeah.
And then there's a new emperor, which I thought the emperors were all gone and it was all tied up at the end of Return of the Jedi. So well, I didn't, maybe yeah, I missed was, something, but where was, did they come from?
Well, there was Snoke, because all the emperors are controlled by the Sith, the real kind of extreme dark force side
but I
of
thought the Sith went at the end of episode 3.
Well, that's what you think, isn't it? That's the whole point of Star Wars. Nothing ever dies in Star Wars, really. And so, it plays out in this one again, the good versus evil. And that is followed through in this new film to its kind of logical conclusion between Kylo Ren and Rey, who's essentially the sort of Luke Skywalker character. But they didn't have that in the original trilogy. They didn't have a clear bad guy. They had Anakin Skywalker, who you meet as a kid, which is kind of wrong because it doesn't fit with the others. When you meet Luke, he's in his late teens, early 20s. When you meet Rey, she's in her late teens, early 20s. When you meet Anakin, he's only 8 years old. Doesn't quite work.
And he's not conflicted or anything.
No,
It would have been interesting to have met him in those teenage years where he starts feeling conflicted about things.
Absolutely. And so that's why that kind of first trilogy, the prequel trilogy, doesn't really feel like it's part of the series. And when I reviewed The Force Awakens, I said it at a stroke gets rid of episodes 1, 2, and 3. Makes them redundant. You don't need them. Mm. So for me, the Star Wars saga is actually 6 movies.
By the way, episode 3, I thought, was quite good.
That was good,
because because Hayden Christensen had learned how to act.
Kind of, yeah.
There's quite a good big fight scene at the end, which explains how he ends up being...
That should have been the first film of that that prequel trilogy. That should have been the first one. And then they should have done two other. Then Rogue One should have been brought in as part of that trilogy, because Rogue One is essentially episode 3.9, because it ends just as episode 4 begins.
If you don't know Star Wars, you're going to be listening to this and wondering what earth we're discussing.
Well, Rogue One was a spin-off that came out a few years ago.
Have I seen Rogue One?
It's really good.
If I have.
I really like Rogue One.
I'm just trying to think of any memories of it whatsoever, because it does all blur into one.
Rogue One is, because it doesn't involve any of the main characters. It doesn't involve Luke or Chewie or Leia, kind of briefly it does, but it's not about them. It's about another group of the Rebel Resistance.
The other thing as well about what I was just saying before about the third episode where Jimmy Smits from LA Law raises Luke Skywalker, which always made me laugh, is that they called him Skywalker, so therefore Darth Vader could have found him at any moment. And so we have to presume he chose not to, which is a bit weird.
Yes.
Should we play I Am Your Father? Should we just play that little bit? Because, of course, this is the big crescendo bit of episode The New Hope, and then we'll get on to the new movie.
There's no escape. Don't make me destroy you. Luke, you do not yet realize your importance. You have only begun to discover your power. Join me, and I will complete your training. With our combined strength, we can end this destructive conflict and bring order to the galaxy.
I'll never join you!
If you only knew the power of the dark side, Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No. I am your father.
The soundtrack, even then, they got it. They knew that was brilliant. And that sent chills down my spine still, I Am Your Father.
It's amazing. I think out of all of them, The Empire Strikes Back is my favourite.
And I Am Your Father, you'd know what movie that is. There's not very many movie lines where you know exactly where it comes from. Okay, so then we had, after the three and Return of the Jedi, we had I keep forgetting what it's called.
Force Awakens. Number seven.
Which again was sort of a rehash of A New Hope.
Yeah.
Then we had The Last Jedi, which got torn apart by a lot of fans who demanded it was actually torn up and remade.
Yes.
And that's because a lot of them felt that diversity boxes were being ticked and a lot of screen time was being given to characters that actually we'd never met before, when a lot of the action could have been given to established characters.
Was against the character called Rose, who I actually like her as a character. She does appear back in this film, the new one. I liked her character. The problem was that she was put together with Finn, John Boyega's character, and sent off on a mission that actually, even though it took up about 45 minutes of screen time, didn't achieve anything.
Mm.
Because the thing that they set out to do, they didn't do. And then what they did do didn't actually help in any way with what they were going to do after that. So it was completely pointless having this entire section. It was just to give John Boyega's character Finn something to do and bring a new character in.
Which I can understand why people, because I loved it. I found it really exciting. And I think there was some release of some wildlife that was being repressed, which I'm always happy about, but I don't think it needed 45 minutes.
They're not real, though.
I know, but still, I'm still an animal lover, even if it is a fantasy, strange animal thing. Talking of which, my dog, whenever I put Star Wars on, actually starts howling and trying to fight the screen because see all these big things.
Excellent.
So that was where we were at the end of the last one. And of course, I liked that there were, and again, this might have been a diversity box thing, but I loved the fact that there were women in the last ones that actually were quite powerful and took control and helped the situation win. I don't think that's giving away any spoilers, but you've probably seen it by now. So where do we pick up in this new one?
We pick up...
without giving away too much, obviously.
Not really. Yeah. This is the problem. A lot of this film is based on twists and revelations and tying up storylines. So it's really hard to review this without giving anything away. It picks up not long after the end of The Last Jedi. And we have the main now three characters of Finn, Rey, and Poe, the pilot played by Oscar Isaacs, and Chewbacca as well, going off in the Millennium Falcon to find clues. It's got kind of a treasure hunt because, and I'm not giving anything away here because this is in the trailers, Emperor Palpatine, the evil emperor who we thought had died at the end of Episode 6, is actually still alive and is rebuilding a new Imperial fleet to completely control, to reinvigorate the First Order and to take over the universe again. But they need to find out. Nobody knows where they are, where the Emperor is, because it's in a kind of what's deemed a mythical planet that nobody knows its existence. But there is a way of finding it, and Luke was trying to find it. And so they go on this sort of treasure hunt.
And is Luke in it a lot? Does he feature a lot?
Luke does make an appearance in this, as do a lot of other people.
I know that, and again, this is well known, that Billy, what was his name? Of course, he was
Carlson, I think it is.
Billy it's the guy who was who betrayed them in Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, Lando Calrissian. Yeah, yes, he's comes in back. It. Yep.
You can't tell us anything about that.
well, the thing is, there are a lot of moment. There are a lot of references and a lot of nods back to the other films and the original trilogy. Some of which are great, some of which feel like they've just been shoehorned in to give everybody a bit of screen time.
Actually, the reviews I've read have said that it was a bit like, we just need to prove these people are still alive.
Well, even if they're still, even if they died, it doesn't matter.
Because Carrie Fisher's in it, of course.
Well, Carrie Fisher, her character hadn't died. One of the things I disliked about The Last Jedi was that her character had this amazing, beautiful death where she was in one of the spacecraft and which was attacked and destroyed, and she was sucked out into space and she had this beautiful death moment and then came back to life. And I was like, no, just let her. Oh, it would have been a beautiful moment to end her character.
But they didn't know at that point she was going to die in real life, and they wanted to give her more time.
Exactly, because the plan was that in this new trilogy of films, the first one would feature predominantly Han Solo. And Harrison Ford said he would come back and do it only if his character could die at the end of it, which is what happens. The second one would be all about Luke Skywalker. The third one would be all about Princess Leia, or General Ortega, as she is now. Unfortunately, as you say, Carrie Fisher died before filming started. And they had to rewrite huge swathes of the script, which had already had to be rewritten because Rian Johnson, who wrote and directed The Last Jedi, hadn't taken the story in the way that they planned, and it completely messed up the plans they had for this third part of the trilogy.
So, sometimes the same happened with Superman as well, one of my favourite ones, in the first and second one being filmed concurrently. And sometimes this drama off screen, if they filmed that, it would be more interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because apparently George Lucas is also devastated that some of his ideas weren't taken on board.
Well, he'd originally planned out the whole thing in nine episodes.
And they bought his ideas for seven, eight, and nine and just ignored them. Yeah. Okay, so Leia is in it, but not very much.
Yeah, they use footage from the other two films in this trilogy, and then wrote scenes around it, which is quite clever. They haven't just CG'd her into the film.
No, it was, what's it called? Sort of deleted scenes and scenes that they hadn't used.
Yeah.
What questions do we get answered without telling us the answers? So do we find out who Rey is, for instance?
Yes, that's one of the key elements of the film. Yeah.
And is it a surprise?
For me, it was a surprise. Oddly enough, my 11-year-old daughter, who hasn't yet seen this film, worked it out.
Amazing. Okay.
Yeah, incredible. For me, it was a huge
twist. Isn't she our film critic?
I don't know. She should be. She completely got it. So that's one of the main ones, yeah.
Does Daisy Ridley act any better? Because she's a dreadful actress.
She's the same as she is in the other films.
Okay, right. Well, okay, you're not going to get any Oscar performances in Star Wars anyway, are you?
No.
Okay, what else can you tell us without telling us anything?
Adam Driver's really good.
He's an amazing actor. He's actually really good, blossoming into such a brilliant actor.
Yeah, and the film actually concentrates a lot between his relationship, between Kylo Ren and Rey's, their relationship, and the connection that they have.
Do we find out what that is, and does it make sense when you find out who Rey is?
Not necessarily. but the way that they have a connection.
In the last one, they were sort of talking to each other when they worked with each other, and it was all about the force and all
that. But they take that idea and move it to another level, which is very clever. And that's one of the things I did like about it. Mm. And Adam Driver really does, you know, forgive me for saying it, drive the film. You know, there isn't enough.
He's such a funny looking fellow, Adam Driver, but it works.
Like, it works brilliantly, yeah.
Because he's got an amazing, like, he is not, I don't think I'm being unkind when I say he's not got traditional movie star looks, but he's got an amazing charisma on screen.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's brilliant in the role. And his character actually is the one that has the best story arc within the film.
Because we've got, like you said, Kylo Ren, who is the pilot of the Kylo Ren is him. Who am I thinking of?
Or Ben Skywalker? You're thinking of Poe, who is the rebel.
Ben Skywalker.
Ben Skywalker is actually Kylo Ren. Ben Skywalker is the son of Leia and Han Solo.
Oh, I never knew his proper name.
He then was turned to the dark side and became Kylo Ren in the same way that Anakin Skywalker became Darth Vader.
Because what I want to happen, you won't tell me whether it's true, but I kind of have always thought that somehow Ren was his twin sister or something, in the same way as a nod back to Leia and Luke, and that somehow she was separated from the family, and that we find out that that's how it all came about. But I don't know whether you're looking at me, and I don't know whether you can tell me whether that's true or not, so we won't.
I'm going to be a politician and say I can neither confirm nor deny these rumours.
And so we find out who she is. Do we find out why John Boyega is in it at all?
No. We know about him is that he was a stormtrooper. This is in, you know, The Force Awakens, and he broke his programming as such. I mean, he's a human, but he broke his sort of, you know, his training and decided not to follow orders and to flee the First Order and give up being a stormtrooper. What we do learn is that he's not the only one that's done that.
Okay.
Which is interesting. I'm not going to say any more than that, but he's not then a one-off character like that.
And, okay, so we find out that. Is there anything else that you can reveal without revealing?
They manage to get into certain situations and then mysteriously get out of them without any explanation of how they get out of them, which is quite interesting.
I mean, there are more plot holes in that than you'd find in a Swiss cheese in the Star Wars.
There is. I was talking to my wife earlier, because she's a massive Star Wars fan and she hates the fact that I've seen it and she hasn't. And she said to me, she asked me if something particular happens, which I won't say what it is. And I said, I'm not going to tell you whether this thing, and this thing does happen. And I know she's going to absolutely hate it. And I know my daughter is going to hate it when they see it. But also I know that there's a twist to it as well. So I'm going to sit there and watch them go through this torture.
This is the most difficult review you've ever done. Because you can't say anything.
Because otherwise it will just spoil it. And I don't want to spoil it. But there are there certainly is one particular moment when I was kind of quite shocked. And I thought, oh God, I really wasn't expecting that. And then it sort of resolves itself. And I thought, I actually quite liked it if it stayed as it was, really.
I mean, did you believe it? Did you feel sold on it when you left, not just that moment, but I mean the whole thing. When you left the cinema, did you say, actually, that has wrapped it all up for me? Great.
No, there were swathes of this film, where I was completely underwhelmed and I was sat there just thinking, oh, I'll just get on to the next scene because this isn't going anywhere. But once we got into the final hour, when the big sort of climax to the film is, and once you finally work out what they're actually going to do, because they've got to go
and infiltrate the big base of the nasty people and try and blow it all up whilst fighting each other separately, but it's
done in a much, much bigger way than, the original trilogy.
And do we only see, I want to ask whether Leia survives the movie or whether they actually do then kill her off, but I don't suppose you can tell me that either, can you?
I don't want to tell
you
that.
Don't tell me.
But it's actually quite beautiful in the way that, you know, I said that the moment where she died and came back to life in The Last Jedi, I really disliked.
But was that because you knew that they'd have to kill her because of real life? If she'd stayed alive, would you have? Okay.
No, I just didn't think it was unnecessary for her to come back. But
I thought it showed that she had such amazing, and she was such a Jedi by then, that she could even go into a terrible accident and have her body blown apart, but she still survived.
Didn't that sell you on the power of the Jedi? No, because the moment...
What is wrong with you? Are you on the dark side?
No, but the moment was so beautiful. It was such a beautiful death for her. for her to then come back to life, for me, just didn't seem to work. I like what they've done with her character. She's not in it a lot. Not certainly not anywhere near as much as they originally planned, because it was supposed to be, you know, her.
And I would have loved to have seen that.
I would have loved to have seen as well. But what they have done, and they have been very clever in using footage from the other two films,
using what they've got well,
and doing, you know, sort of over the shoulder shots of where you get somebody else wearing the same costume and you just shoot over their shoulders so you can do the other side of the scene, which you've now just rewritten. And there are a couple of moments which they've been very artistically clever. To have her character in there, even though they haven't got, you know, Carrie Fisher playing the part, because they didn't, they were given permission by her family to use the footage, but not to CG her into it in the same way that Peter Cushing was CG'd into Rogue One, which looked terrible.
Mm.
So I think that there are a couple of really beautiful moments with her character, but it would have been nice to have, if they could have had more, but obviously, you know, they couldn't because she died, unfortunately.
Which is,
Tragedy.
And also just when they got it back together to start making it again, and she was looking great. And I really loved that she was, you know, whereas she was a bit feisty and, dare I say, a bit annoying in the three, you know, original ones. I felt that she was almost like, she was regal, actually. You know, she was much more reserved, regal. I thought her performance was brilliant.
Yes. And she, you know, her character had changed in that sort of, you know, 20, 30 year period.
In the story. And having the force as well, and using it properly. I mean, she's possibly one of my favourite characters in it. And so she would obviously not be in it anymore. All right. So, well, I suppose people would be recommended. If you're a Star Wars fan, you've got to go and see it.
Well, the thing is, it's almost pointless reviewing this film. Not to talk about it. It's great. But it's pointless to review this film because you already know if you're going to watch it or not. There's nobody listening now thinking, I wasn't going to go and see that because I haven't seen any of them, but now I go, no, what that's not going to happen.
What is this new Star Wars you speak of? This great new, is it a new film that's come out? Thank you, John Hearn, film critic. We think we like it. I can't wait to see it. And if that hasn't wet your whistle.
I will see it again.
Will you?
Yeah, definitely.
I want to do all nine.
I'd love to do that. There was somebody in America, there was a competition to pay somebody in America $1,000 to watch all nine films, one after the other.
Hmm.
It takes sort of 22 hours.
I did a 3-hour Alien trilogy at one, because that's another one which is brilliant.
Oh, fabulous.
Similarly to what you're saying about Palpatine,
because
I think Aliens is one of the best science fiction films of all time. I think it's brilliant.
The second one is the best.
Second one, absolutely. But then, because in the third one, again, I'm not spoiling anything, as it turns out, they still had an alien on board and they hadn't killed it after all. That really annoyed me because it was like, well, that's completely invalidated everything they went through in the second one, and they should have come up with a third one that didn't compromise that.
Yes.
So that's annoying that they've done that a little bit here. Donna, thank you very much indeed for that one. We'll be back with some of your texts about this. Got one here from Wayne, who is, looking forward to the He-Man movie, which is interesting. We'll talk about that. And we'll do some of the front pages. And Daryl might pop in as well and tell us what's coming up in his programme. So all of that and more here on Talk Radio.
Christo Fufas on Talk Radio.
Is an amazing theme as well, and it's quite rare actually. You hear a few themes, you go, right, I know that, I know exactly. And the Superman one is quite similar to the Star Wars one as well, where, and E.T. as well. Is this John Williams? John Williams, you know what? Someone should give him a job in music because he's quite good, isn't he? Hi, it's Christo here on Talk Radio. We've been talking about the new Star Wars movie, the sort of franchises you can't get enough of. Now Disney have got the Star Wars franchise, they will flog it to death, so I'd expect there to be more films, says someone on Twitter. Another one here saying, whilst I don't care much for Star Wars, I'm sure I read a few months ago there was a new He-Man movie coming out in 2020. Thank you for that. And Daniel says, talking Star Wars you are. I'm not going to do a Yoda voice. Sorry. Let's do the front pages that you're waking up to this morning here on Talk Radio. Then we'll find out from Daryl what's coming up on his fantastic overnight show. Hedge funds eavesdrop on vital bank briefings, says the Times this morning. Hedge funds have been eavesdropping on the Bank of England's press conferences before they are officially broadcast after its internal systems were hijacked. This is a Times scoop, discovering that one of its suppliers has been sending an audio feed of its press conferences to high-speed traders who try to profit by acting on the governor's comments before the rest of the world.
Interesting scoop there. What else? Jimmy White's girl, glassed in face, says the Star. I don't know who he is. I don't know who she is. Daily Express. Boris, I will wrap up Brexit in a week. Or as I like to say, the latest Tory press release just printed verbatim on the front page. The Daily Mail. Boris's high street boost. Much of the same again. No journalism. Just pretty much what Downing Street is saying and stick it on the front page. Guardian. Thornbury vows to stand and hits out at Labour's catastrophic folly. Well, when Emily Thornbury is the answer, you have to ask whether you've got the right question. Daily Mirror, flood victims facing Christmas in the car. This is a couple left homeless in last month's floods. Telegraph, Johnson to enshrine new £34 billion NHS boost. Which is interesting on that one. And the Metro has gone for Blair, Labour is a comedy cult. And the FT going for armed forces funding crisis set to put operational readiness in peril. We don't have the Sun at the moment. And of course, as soon as we have that one, I'm sure Daryl will have that when he is in here. And of course, he can bring that to you with his wonderful overnight show, because of course I am a mere warm-up act. I'm sweeping the stage, frankly, for the talent when they actually manage to get on air. And he really is one of the most I can't read your handwriting here. talented broadcasters talented. Of all time. Was that all right?
It was perfect spot on, thank you.
Thanks.
How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. Yes, all good. Eyes in America at the moment.
Why does your hair feel like?
Yeah, okay, so this is my suggestion for a talking point tonight, which I noticed you've ignored.
No, I didn't. I replied.
Oh, did you? Oh, right. I
said
that.
It's because you never allow me to ruffle your hair when I come near you.
Oh, I see.
And I think that's probably for legal reasons.
Yeah. You know what the judge said.
I know exactly what the judge said, and we shouldn't actually even be this close to each other.
No.
So America, quite seriously, you'll be crossing live to impeachment debates.
Indeed, absolutely. Yeah, we've got Ryan Harris in America for us. We're also going to speak to US political commentator Adam Newman, who's going to take us through it pan by pan. Actually, Adam's going to be really useful in explaining it, because I think it's one of those things that's maybe just slightly abstract to us. It's not our political system. Actually, for many people, this is the first time in their lifetime that they've experienced something like this. Clinton, perhaps a little beyond the horizon, and it's fascinating, isn't it? It's absolutely fascinating, and it's all about gameplay. This is a game being played here by everybody in this process.
I can't help but feel like it won't lead to anything.
Well, this is the really big question. That is the $1 million question here. Christo, is where does this leave all parties, really? I don't think you can underestimate how much of a risk it is for the Democrats to do this, because they will claim that they feel it's their constitutional obligation to do it. Some people are a little bit sceptical about that, given the fact that there perhaps wasn't the killer blow from the documents and from the testimony that was given and that was revealed. But they will say that they've got a constitutional right to do it, a constitutional obligation. In reality, it's about cementing mistrust between him and America ahead of next year's election.
It amazes me that more Republicans who are reasoned in their way of thinking, and maybe that's a contradiction in terms with the way things are with politics at the moment, aren't just saying, you know what, the president has actually admitted to the fact that he spoke like this to the Ukrainian president. It seems so odd that they wouldn't just say that's really inappropriate.
Yeah, and that's
without all of this.
Yeah, and actually, do you know what? That's part of the game, isn't it? Really, here is what's more important to them: having a Republican in the White House or having the right person in the White House.
And I suppose it ties into what's happening here, because a lot of people held their nose and stomached Boris's lies, which they were.
Yeah.
I mean, love or loathe him, he didn't tell the truth many times during the campaign.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
they thought, well, you know what? But being a Conservative and not having Labour in government was more important to us than whether the person we voted for is particularly honest.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of that's happening in the States with the Republicans.
Exactly. And in both directions, actually. And I think you'll probably find the same happens again. That the key question really remains. And look, this isn't going to move the dial for Trump's base. They will support him regardless. It isn't going to remove the dial for those people who dislike him, of course. They're already there. And the number of people who find themselves in between is so finite now that, that actually, I wonder what kind of impact they will have. And I wonder if this will really honestly move the dial on how they feel too. I mean, it might do, but it could also expose the Democrats as being opportunistic, or it could expose Trump as being unreliable.
So a lot to talk about there. Anything else?
Oh, is that it? I mean, you moving on?
Go on.
Moving me on?
Yeah, moving you on. Come on. We've done enough.
Is that it then? Is
no,
it?
No, no, no. Okay, moving you on to talk about something else.
Oh, you're more from me. Yeah. Right, okay, I see. Okay, oh, okay, so God. we'll get
it's like
into all
of a work experience in the studio.
We'll get into all of that throughout the night. A couple of times we're going to head to America.
Yeah.
I was going to say we're going to have the first review of Star Wars, but you've ran on that parade.
Yeah, I've stolen that.
Thank you very much.
They decided that they wanted the more superior program to have that.
Clearly.
So go on.
Clearly. You've actually, if only you were wrong. If only that was a joke.
I go from loving you to loathing you in just a split second, Daryl.
It keeps me on my toes though, doesn't it? You got me where you want me. We'll talk about that though, we will. We'll talk about The Simpsons as well. And we're also going to hear, this is a bit left field, but we're also going to hear from the woman who's been employed, a 28-year-old woman called Sian, who's been employed to take care of a wall in Orkney. Her full-time job is to protect and to continue and to ensure that this wall in Orkney stays in place.
Why?
You will find out why.
Is it a Trumpian wall? I mean, should she go and work for Trump?
No, it's not Trump. It's not Trumpian. It's not. It's much nicer. It's a much nicer reason for that.
All right. So all of that and more coming up with Daryl, and that's in just a few minutes' time here on Talk Radio, because that is it from me. Tomorrow, it's going to be Jamie East who's here.
Oh, thank God for that.
And thank you. Thank you for being my agent. That was there. and then I think it's Howard Hughes who's going to be holding the fort for the next couple of weeks as well. So make sure you stay with Talk Radio for that, but don't go anywhere, because frankly no one would want to fill in for him. Daryl Morris is coming up next here on Talk Radio.
This is Talk Radio.